Good afternoon. On behalf of LaRouche PAC, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's event. My name is Deborah Freeman, and as some of you know, I serve as Lyndon LaRouche's national spokeswoman and as his representative here in Washington, D.C. There probably is no more timely occasion than this for Mr. LaRouche to address this audience and, in fact, the nationwide and international audience that is listening. I'd like to remind people that it was approximately a month ago, on June 22nd, that Mr. LaRouche wrote an editorial that appeared in the weekly magazine Executive Intelligence Review. The title of that editorial was "Time is Running Out." And in that editorial, Mr. LaRouche made an attempt to prepare both the population and our elected representatives for what was coming, so that, in fact, they could take action. The recommended action was not designed to stop the impending collapse. There really isn't anything that can do that. But it was designed so that those in a position of responsibility could take the necessary action to mitigate the suffering that that collapse would cause the American people, and at the same time to make sure that we preserved our capability to build out of that collapse. At the time that that warning was issued, although it was taken seriously by many here in Washington and around the world, it was, as is often the case, taken also as a somewhat metaphorical statement. And many people responded by saying that, yes, indeed, these were very difficult times and we were dealing with a strategic situation that could, in fact, be referred to as a crisis. But to say that, in fact, we were on the brink of World War III, that we were on the brink of not only a financial crisis, but a strategic crisis of enormous dimension, well, the response was that that was just Lynn trying to make a point. Well, here we are, less than 4 weeks later. And once again, I'm in a position where I can take the podium and say unequivocally that LaRouche was right. Now, I wish I could bring you a whole, a whole series of items that would represent good news. But in fact, I can't. And if one were to base their state of mind on the current behavior of this government and the current behavior of the United States Congress, well, you'd really not be a happy person at all. Because, in fact, point after point, when this Congress has had the ability to take action, they have not. And I think that what we saw this week with the Senate's unanimous passage of a resolution supporting the barbarity that is currently being carried out by the government of Israel, we see that very often we should be grateful when they don't do anything, because when they do something, it is all too often the wrong thing. Many people will say to those of us who represent Mr. LaRouche, you know, I think that what LaRouche is saying is true. I think he's right. I wish your group was bigger or had greater resources, because I just don't know if you can win. And then they look at you and they say, do you really think you can win? And, you know, it's a fair question to ask, I suppose. And the answer, if one answers honestly, is that, yes, we can win, but that, in fact, based on the manner in which they assess things, the odds of winning are not necessarily that good. But there actually is an element of good news in there. And that is that while we have no guarantee of victory in this situation, we've got a shot at it. Our enemies cannot say that. The one thing that we can say with absolute certainty, and for those of you who are familiar with this organization and familiar in particular with Mr. LaRouche, it is very rare that we issue guarantees. But the one thing that I am prepared to absolutely guarantee is that our enemies, the enemies of this nation and the enemies of humanity, absolutely cannot win. And under those circumstances, the wise thing to do, as well as the moral thing to do, is to take the shot that we have at preserving this nation and preserving this nation as a leader of a drive toward progress. Mr. LaRouche is one of the few people who is prepared to actually stand at the helm of such a movement. And in fact, that is precisely what he has done week in, week out, despite the less than courageous actions by some of the people whom we are seeking to assist. That is the backdrop of today's event. That is, in part, the message that the LaRouche Youth Movement has spread throughout the city during the first 3 days of the week, and which they will continue to spread throughout the city into today and tomorrow. It is also the message, along with what Mr. LaRouche says today, that will be carried across the United States. And now that I'm certain that there's no longer a line outside, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Lyndon LaRouche.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. An Israeli friend of mine who is well known in Israel and outside of Israel as a leading strategic thinker had a discussion with my wife in the past 24 hours on the situation in the Middle East. And it was said, in his opinion, from a standpoint of Israeli interests, that what is going on now would not be continued much longer in terms of Israeli aggression in the Middle East. Unless, he said, unless this is a strategic move by other sources which are now pushing for an immediate response to an impending general economic collapse of the world economic monetary system. In point of fact, the world economic financial system and much of the political system at the same time is presently in the process of collapse. And for that reason, because there's a correlation between what's going on in Southwest Asia, what's going on in India, what was going on in the context of the G8 summit in Petersburg, in Russia, we're on the verge of a condition tantamount to the guns of August of 1914 and 1939. Now, we're not looking at a war of the type that we would class as World War I or World War II. We're talking about something worse, not less dangerous. We're talking about the danger of a general disintegration of global civilization. And it all is tied together with the present economic situation. This being the case, and the facts to this effect having been presented to leading circles in the U.S. Congress and elsewhere, the U.S. Senate in particular, Why has the Congress behaved like a bunch of braying asses? And being a braying ass does not qualify you as a Democrat. But they seem to have thought they were. But they're because they're baby boomers. Now, baby boomer is not exactly a generation. And I shall speak to you today as being very nigh on to 84 years of age, and therefore have a corresponding experience of life, which is probably richer than most people of my age group, because I was active in certain ways as a youngster. I lived through the 1920s, through a generation of my parents and older people who were better called degenerates, because they were corrupt. This was the age of Coolidge and the age of Wilson. And our society was immensely corrupt. But when the time came, and when the Hoover administration had led the U.S. economy down by one half in physical condition, over the period from 1929, the end of 29, to February, the end of February of 1933, we had a president who fortunately was not assassinated, though many of the Democratic Party leadership at that time wanted him assassinated and even planned to do it, but didn't succeed because an honest general and some other people, a Marine general, blew the whistle on it, and they couldn't pull off the coup d'etat to do a Nazi-style coup inside the United States. We are fortunate to have a President Roosevelt who led this nation to save the world from what otherwise would have been inevitably a Hitler dictatorship worldwide. A Hitler dictatorship conceived by leading banking interests, financial interests, which are the same interests behind Felix Rohatyn and similar forces in the world today. So you are facing today exactly the same evil that we faced in the form of Adolf Hitler and Mussolini and so forth. And we're facing it at the hands of the descendants of exactly the same circles of financiers in other circles which were behind Hitler then, circles inside the United States, inside France, inside the Netherlands, inside Britain, as well as inside Spain, Italy, and inside Germany. The same thing, the same crowd, with the same ultimate objectives. Now, I lived through these experiences. I lived through the moment that Franklin Roosevelt died. And I came back to the United States from military service abroad in the spring of 1946. The country had changed. The passing of Roosevelt had meant a moral degeneration of our country. I saw my friends who had been heroes in warfare, who had been courageous, turned into stinking cowards under the Truman administration and what it represented. Because Truman was on the opposite side from Roosevelt and did everything he could to destroy the life's work of Franklin Roosevelt at the moment that Roosevelt died. But they couldn't get rid of one thing. The whole world was bankrupt, and only the United States, as Roosevelt had led it to recovery, was capable of providing the basis for a recovery of the world economy. And so until the middle of the 1960s, the Bretton Woods system and some of the other essential economic intentions for the domestic United States and abroad were carried through. So we had a period of recovery of much of the world over a period of 20 years, even after Roosevelt had died. And that continued until about the beginning of the war in Indochina, which was made possible by the assassination of a president of the United States, Kennedy, who was one of a series of targets of assassination and similar things, like President Charles de Gaulle of France was a target of assassination by the same forces, the Nazi forces, the same force exactly behind Felix Rohatyn in the United States and abroad today. So we had the Indochina War. It was a demoralization of our population to be in such a war. This is the worst kind of war to be involved in. Long wars. It has been called a Dark Age war. It was called Armageddon now, later. It had many of those characteristics as the kind of war you never fight if you can avoid it, unless it's forced on you. You never seek it out. You never try to fight it. You never declare it. You may declare against it, but you'll never declare it. Not if you're human. Not if you're sane. Not if you're moral. As you wouldn't have started this war in Iraq. If you'd been insane, if you'd been sane, you wouldn't have done it. If you'd been moral, you wouldn't have done it. There was never a reason. It was based on lies, and it's still based on lies by a president who's not called a criminal because he's insane. And I mean it. He is insane. He's a puppet, but a dangerous puppet, a malicious puppet. Right? We lived through this. I lived through these things before. What the object here, and I'll give you two lessons today, which I give in other locations, but I'll give them here in this context. One is a history lesson. The other, which is crucial, is an economics lesson. Something that no one in the Congress apparently seems to understand are the basic principles of economy. They don't. You would have to say that if they're innocent, it's because they're stupid when it comes to economics. Because what they're allowing, what they're doing is stupid. And I'll make that clear. In the history of the thing, remember what we are. Is I know it from my experience and people from my note, from their my same age group know. We saved the planet. We saved the planet from Hitler and what that meant. Oh, other people did it too, but without us, without our President Roosevelt, and without our support for that effort, you wouldn't have had the period of growth and peace and so forth that we had, relatively speaking, in recent times. We'd have been living under Nazism or its aftermath. But what happened was, not only did Truman betray the United States, and he betrayed the United States because we knew what the interest was of the United States at the time the war ended. We knew that. What did this bum do? This stinking bum. What did he do? Now, before the war had ended, the Emperor Hirohito of Japan had extended a negotiation to the United States and other nations for a peace treaty. Or an armistice. He had processed it through the diplomatic channels into the Foreign Office of the Vatican, the Secretary of State of the Vatican, and into the office of a special part of the Secretary of State of the Vatican, which was the Extraordinary Affairs Group, then headed by a Monsignor Montini, who later became Pope Paul VI. The conditions for the surrender were arranged with the United States, while Franklin Roosevelt lived. I had a friend of mine who was the head of OSS in Italy at that time, who was a personal observer of the details of that negotiation. This friend of mine was also a friend of General Dunneman, the head of OSS. Both were attached to the Roosevelt tradition. So the facts are known. The facts of this case have been verified by the Vatican more recently to a member of that friend's family. What did Truman do? Japan was defeated. Its situation was hopeless. All that was left was the main island. And you couldn't get a ship in or out of the main island because the United States Air Force and Navy and Army had the thing so securely blockaded that Japan had to surrender. But now Truman became president. Why didn't the United States offer to honor the agreement of armistice with the Emperor of Japan, which would have ended the war, because Truman said, no, we don't honor the agreement. And why didn't he? Because Truman, working with people in Britain and elsewhere, knowing that we had nuclear weapons, Truman didn't know about this until he became president. We had two prototype nuclear weapons, one a uranium bomb, one a plutonium bomb. These are laboratory devices, not production line devices. So we dropped one on Hiroshima, another on Nagasaki, which were civilian cities, civilian populations. Why? We had a defeated enemy, Japan, whose head of state was prepared to surrender. We postponed the surrender in order to bombard two Japan cities with nuclear bombs, the only two we had. We'd had a third one, but used as a prototype for testing in Los Alamos. Why do we do that? Because the Truman policy was directly opposite to Roosevelt's. Roosevelt's policy, and he said to Churchill during the war and said to others, when this war ends, Winston, we're not going to have your British system anymore on this planet. We're going to have the American system. And that means that those colonial nations are going to be freed. We're going to help them develop. He said that repeatedly. He said it in a visit to Morocco, where he laid out the details of the plan for Africa while he was there. What happened? Truman not only dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, on a defeated enemy, unnecessarily. He saved not one American life by that effort. None. He would have saved American lives by giving the armistice terms, presenting them earlier, because attrition did kill some people. So therefore, you stop a war as soon as you can, because simply keeping the war going will mean more people will die, even if you don't make any new attacks. What did Truman did? Well, Indochina had been liberated. By whom? Well, by people from the OSS and by Ho Chi Minh, who was a collaborator of the United States. What did we do? Well, the British requested and Truman allowed. We had Japanese prisoners of war in camps in Indochina. The orders were to release these people from the camps, give them back their weapons, and have them occupy Indochina all over again, which had been liberated by forces associated with the U.S. OSS forces. We did the same kind of thing in Indonesia, which also had struggled for its liberation. The Dutch went in there with allies and butchered the resistance to recolonization. Recolonization was on the agenda. This was the Truman policy. So what happened? Well, as a result of this, Truman was committed to a policy crafted by Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was probably the most evil man of the 20th century. He was the one who devised a policy of using nuclear bombardment, preventive nuclear bombardment, as a way of causing the Soviet Union and other nations to give up national sovereignty, i.e. globalization, and to submit to world government. That was the Truman plan. Recolonize, loot, suppress, lie, kill. Betray everything he dared to betray. That's what he did. We did something else. In this process, we formed a series of organizations, presumably to fight communism. Presumably. But what do they actually do? They targeted the section of the population born approximately between 1945 and 1967. This section of the population that was targeted were people who were going into families which whose children would probably be go to universities and become the leaders of society, the upper crust of society, once they came into maturity. Not the whole generation, but the generation of the upper 20% of family income brackets, the future upper 20%, which became later known as the 68ers. The people who in 1968 massed on the streets and took their clothes off to demonstrate the sincerity and had all kinds of things they did, smoked everything, did everything, and so forth, and decided that people who worked for a living and blue collars, blue shirts, were no good, that farmers were no good, scientists were no good, technology was no good, and scientific and technological progress were no good, and having to work was lousy. This is called the baby boomer. These people were called the golden generation, which I used to refer to as the golden degeneration, known for its brass. So what happened is we have a generation which is now between 50 and 67 years of age from this particular stratum or influenced by this stratum, which has created a culture called the golden generation culture or the baby boomer culture, or we don't fight. We kill, but we don't fight. We got a victim, we kill him. We don't fight. He's got a gun, we don't fight. So what we have done is, if you should look at the figures on what's happened to, sociologically to our country since the beginning of the middle of the Vietnam War, when the 68ers moved, we moved against infrastructure development on which our economy depends. 50% of a healthy economy depends upon basic economic infrastructure, power, water, so forth, municipal care, these kinds of things. 50%. Most of this investment is in the form of investments in facilities or institutions, which have a half-life of 25 years and a full life of 50 years or more. The kinds of things that are wearing out and breaking down and failing today in the United States because we haven't repaired them, we haven't fixed them or replaced them during the past 40-odd years. And it was the baby boomers that did it. They are the ones who came in with the Green Revolution, with Sunday. And that isn't a day of worship. That's a day of deviltry. So we have destroyed our economy deliberately. What we've done is we've destroyed the kind of economy and the kind of society, an egalitarian society, which we had and fought for under Franklin Roosevelt to get it back. After a lot of bum presidents like Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, who were Ku Klux Klan types, and they obviously are not egalitarians, are they? And people like Coolidge, and people like Hoover, who was not personally a bad guy, but he was an instrument of a bad policy, and he did rotten things accordingly. We were being destroyed. We got our country back. Under Roosevelt and a group of people around him who inspired our people who were being oppressed and miserated, and I saw it, and who had done something else. We were a stinking population still in the 30s, I can tell you. I was there. I was in schools, I was in college and so forth, and I saw it. I was on the streets of New York in December 7th, 1941, a Sunday morning, and I was going over to a business appointment from the streets of New York to a hotel where this relevant meeting was occurring. I got there, was a strange mood in the hotel lobby. I couldn't understand it. And then I heard Pearl Harbor had been struck. Now, how did our people react? How did my generation react to that bombardment, to that news? You couldn't keep them from volunteering. There was no good news. There was no easy promise of victory. This was hell. But in fact, for the alliance of the United States, the United Kingdom and the Soviet Union, but for that alliance, you'd be living under Hitler or after Hitler period today. Those were the odds. We in the United States were the gut that saved humanity. And it was people of my generation reacting to 41 and to Roosevelt and to Franklin Roosevelt that mobilized and turned the world around and saved humanity from what would have been otherwise inevitable Nazi terror and occupation of the planet and whatever came after Hitler. And it's exactly that that's being betrayed, and it's exactly that which is the purpose to be that betrayal was the purpose of the policies under which the baby boomer generation, which now dominates the Congress and dominates other leading institutions of society, is raised. And you find the fact of the matter that I have to deal with and you have to deal with in life. You find that over the process, since these events, since the events of 1968 to 1971 and beyond, that people who used to work for a living and trade unionists or this or farmers and so forth, who had pride, over the course of that period, of the 1970s, began to lose their pride. They began to lose their sense that they were important people whose voice was important in shaping the policies of government. You saw a period in the 70s and into the 80s in which the typical person who was in a Democratic Party organization as the popular part began to drift away from parties. There's a separation of the political population. The majority of the population was separated from the idea that the government was theirs, that they owned the government. Not completely, but they had a voice in the government. It was what they said were their interests, which were their interests, or had to be heard as such. Now they don't believe that anymore. The problem we have in the population is the golden generation, so-called, generally 60 to 50 to 65 years of age, which runs most of the institutions as a group with their ideology, says, we make policy. Look what's happening right now to this Senate that wouldn't do a damn thing for the country. They said, we want our riches. We're going for the upper class. What do I mean by the upper class? The upper 20% of family income brackets. We're orienting. We're going to the right wing. We don't want to hear about the lower 80% of the population. We want the lower 80% of the population to be grateful for the fact that we're there. But don't come up to us and ask us to do something for you. Don't ask us to listen to you. Don't ask us to remedy the evils that are done with your consent to us, to our communities. And that's the cultural change. That's what we're up against. Now, I'm not saying that these people are of the golden generation, so-called, or the brassy generation, are evil. I'm saying they're corrupted. They're sophists. They have the same kind of mental disease that Greece had in Athens, that led Athens under Pericles, which had been at that point the leading civilization of the Mediterranean region at that time, and led it into an act of murder on the island of Melos, a Nazi-like murder, which was the beginning of the total corruption of Greece, and led to the Peloponnesian War, which was the end of the hegemony of Greek civilization at that time. We in the United States, the Athens of America, we have allowed the generation, just the way it was done in ancient Greece, in Athens, before the Peloponnesian War, we allowed the young generation, the people being raised to become adults, to rise at the time of their maturity, when they reached about the age of 20 and so forth, to be the golden generation of Pericles, of the golden age of Pericles, which was the doom of Greece. And we created a golden generation among us, the baby boomer generation, the upper 20% of family income brackets that bought into this deal. And the way this was done was by a very evil organization led formerly in the United States by Sidney Hook. a personal enemy of mine. And the American Family Foundation, another evil institution. Large think tanks, influential institutions, evil institutions. The corruption of our universities, the corruption of our campuses, the destruction of competent education, the brainwashing of people in all categories of education is what was done to us. We have become the Athens of America, self-doomed, because of the golden generation. Now, the only way you're going to get this thing solved is in part through an upsurge of the masses of people who do not wait for permission for the voice of the lower 80% of our family income brackets to speak of their rights, to speak of their interest, to speak of the interests of their generation, of the coming generation, their children, their grandchildren. And the second thing, we have to find among the golden generation people such as Bill Clinton and others who are decent human beings personally and have good intentions, though they have the taint and corruption of being part of their generation. We have to get them to treat their generation as a disease and set out to cure that disease instead of adapting to it. The tendency of the baby boomer is they will not share anything except their diseases, especially their mental diseases. And that's what they do. And we want Bill Clinton to reform and to become a prophet of what has to be done rather than what he wants to adapt to. I know that'll take a lot of guts on his part. I think he's got the guts to do it under the right circumstances and with the right kind of support from people immediately around him. But that's our problem. We can save the nation. We can save civilization. There's no guarantee that it will work, but it's the only shot we have. Just as in Pearl Harbor Day, 1941. It's the only shot we have. It's either fight that war or give up, and give up everything we live for, and give up the future of our people. We are going to fight because we have to fight, because we have no alternative but to fight. Not because we seek war, but because it has been forced upon us. A fight to save civilization. Now, as you know, most people aren't civilized. That's a problem. And this comes to economics. The basic problem, that's why I'm turning to economics here today, not just economics as a subject per se, but economics as a moral issue, an issue of personal morality, which most people lack. They don't know what personal morality is in terms of economics. They don't know what the difference is between man and an ape. That's the problem. Every species of animal has a general limitation on its population density. The limitation is relative. It's relative to the conditions under which the animal lives, or the animal species lives. But has a limit. Man is not. If man were a higher ape, our population on this planet would never have exceeded several million individuals at any one time. We now have over 6 billion. How did that happen? And the greatest part of this growth in population, the rate of growth and improvement in condition of life of the average human being on the planet, miserable as it is in some parts, has occurred since the beginning of the 15th century. With the Golden Renaissance. And it began in Europe. So in European civilization, in the 15th century, there was the beginning of a change where the life expectancy and size of the population, the conquest of disease, the improvement of powers of man in production and so forth, and improvements in statecraft, in the organization of society, all began there. That is a significant stage. We now have over 6 billion people. And that involves some problems, some challenges we can meet. So that's not the problem. But we have 6 billion people. Why do we have 6 billion people? Because we're not apes. Much as many members of our Congress seem to believe they are. What's the difference in economics? And it's the issue which is central to my work in economics in particular is called creativity. Now, people use the word creativity loosely. I mean, if a guy learns how to unzip his fly, it's called creativity. This is not what I mean. If he can't unzip his fly, that may be a lack of creativity, but that's a different problem. That's a different kind of problem. And he knows when to do it and when not to do it. That's also very important. Now, it's the discovery of a universal principle. Now, in the first instance, we think of universal principles as universal physical principles. And one of the paradigms for this is Johannes Kepler's unique discovery of the principle of universal gravitation. And nobody else but Johannes Kepler made it. Yeah? What is this difference? Is that mankind, the human mind, is capable of discovering universal physical principles in the universe which no animal could do. We transmit these discoveries, if we're decent about it, we transmit the reenactment of these same discoveries to other human beings who can reenact this discovery because they too are human. We concentrate on educating our populations so they are prepared to go through the experience of reenacting these kinds of discoveries. To some degree, this is limited to professions, but it spills over from one profession into the population more generally. And this is creativity. Creativity also occurs in a different form. It occurs in the form of classical art, true classical art, not classical because it's ancient or classical because it's habitual, but because it has the same principle in it as the discovery of a universal physical principle such as gravitation. For example, we concentrate in the youth movement on things like the Bach Jesu meine Freude motet. Because that, in order to perform this competently, and that takes some help from people who are masters of it, in order to perform it competently, you have to do something except you don't sing the notes. You have to do something much more. You have to understand how to integrate the performance of the voices in such a way that the intention of Bach comes forth. This means that you cannot simply read a score, note by note. I sing my note. I know my note. I sing my note. Well, a monkey can do that. But this requires, monkeys can't do Bach. They just can't do it. Some try, but they can't. Because in classical art, you have the same thing. You have social processes, social relations, such as polyphony, classical polyphony, singing of it, the same kind of processes which you use for physical scientific discoveries are used now applied to social relations. This includes not only music, as in the Bach tradition, it also includes the natural law, the formation of law, all the other kinds of things we do to impart and share the potentialities of the human mind as unique, as different from the apes, in our social life. Creativity. Now, in the case as in, just stick to Kepler, his discovery of gravitation. Now, the usual explanation is nonsense. What Kepler discovered was the basis for the Leibniz calculus. That is that the principle of gravitation, the way it functioned, as Kepler measured this very precisely, is a constant rate of change in motion within the orbit. That is, the elliptical orbit does not determine the motion determines the elliptical orbit. Now, what Kepler emphasized is this particular characteristic is a principle of the universe. Now, as others understood after him, such as Einstein in the 1950s when he commented on this thing in some detail, is that the principle of gravitation is universal. It exists as a universal in the universe, as an acting universal, so that the universe is therefore finite because there is nothing outside the reach of gravitation. There are other principles which, like gravitation, the principle of gravitation, are universal. And to the extent they are determined to be validly universal, we know that they reach as far as the universe does at all times. And the universe is finite in respect to these principles. This man discovers. Now, therefore, these kinds of principles and the discovery by the human mind, something no animal can do, which defines the human being. And a just society, particularly with modern society with our access to things, a just society does two things. First of all, it demands that every child be brought into this world and developed with the ability, which is natural to them, but the development of the ability to understand and recognize universal principles, both of physical principles and principles of classical artistic composition. In this way, scientific progress is necessary for us not merely because we need it materially to meet human needs. Scientific and classical artistic progress is necessary because we need it for our soul's sake. We need to be human. And we need to be human in the sense that what we discover, that we transfer to people after us when we die, lives on. So that our brief mortal life is a moment in eternity, which lives in eternity, because our living life participates in the universe for all time. And it's this perception, this understanding of oneself and what it is to be human, which defines a moral society, which is the willingness to die if necessary for one's nation in order to perpetuate these values for future generations of humanity, and also to honor the previous generations which have given us these gifts to share. We require technological progress, scientific progress, not merely to become richer or more powerful, though we need that. We need scientific and technological progress and cultural progress because we need to be immortal, as no animal can be. We need to participate in the discovery and application of universal physical principles and artistic principles that no animal could do. And when we find our motivation and our morality in that, we are morally invincible. And what happened with the baby boomer generation is many of them will pretend to be Christians. I laugh. Go tell God. Because they are not committed to anything right. Look at your gaping audience of stupid creatures, these tweeners. You see these films, these television films, of these masses of tweeners with a couple of old fakers on the platform, going through fundamentalism like Tyndall DeHaze fools. Huh? Dupes. They call themselves Christians. They love Jews so much they're going to go out and kill them. Like Tim DeHaze. Huh? They are Christians? No. This is fakery. But there is something real. There is the reality of the importance of recognizing the nature of the immortality of the individual as distinct from the animals. And that the motive in life is to serve that sense of immortality in an efficient way. And to honor those who have gone before us as immortal for us, as we must commit ourselves to future generations of all humanity. Because there are no human races. There's only one human race. All human beings of whatever background have biologically approximately the same potential for creativity. It's just a question of what happens to them and how they develop, and whether we help them develop or not. So therefore, that's to be our motive. Therefore, when you face a situation like this, the threat of war, and we are facing a threat of war worse than anything we could imagine from World War I or II. That's what we face now. We face global asymmetric warfare. We're facing a form of hell which no man knows. But you have the force of evil. And Felix Rahatan is evil. Some people say you shouldn't call him a Nazi. Well, why not? He is. Well, he doesn't like it. Well, time to wash. Wash himself for a change. Now, the problem is Felix is really evil. He's not evil in the sense that he stole a tart. He's evil in the sense that he's made himself immortally, intrinsically evil. Because he's dedicated to the destruction of humanity. And he represents a group of people just exactly like that behind Hitler, exactly the same. Which has a conception of they want a planet with less than 1 billion people on it. They want the elimination of the nation state. They want globalization controlled by these financier interests. The same thing that the Hitler movement was for. The same thing the people behind Hitler were for. Return to the Crusades. Remember the history of this thing. You have Charlemagne develops a world order in collaboration with the Islamic culture of the Arab Baghdad Caliphate, in collaboration with Jews who were the mediation largely in the work between Harun al-Rashid of Baghdad and Charlemagne. These forces moved to destroy what Charlemagne was trying to build. And they took a bunch of gangsters who were called the Norman Chivalry, working for Phoenician usurers, and they set up a system called the Crusades. And they killed everybody, Muslims, Jews, everyone, and destroyed society, destroyed civilization. What Rahatan represents is a process, a movement, which has continued to exist in the Venetian tradition since that time, which has moved in and is determined to create what's called a globalized world order. A globalized world order in which much of society is destroyed, in which most nation states which presently exist disappear from the planet, which the population is down to, say, 3/4 of 1 billion people, or less, in a fairly short order, and in which the world is run by syndicates of bankers. Privatized warfare. What happened, for example, the case of Halliburton? What is Halliburton? And Rahatan and George Shultz and the Cheney crowd, Rumsfeld crowd, are all for this. Destroy the control of the military by governments. Turn military functions over to private armies like Halliburton. Destroy the regular military. And let private armies controlled by syndicates of financier power run the world by force. We had a proposal like that in the sort of the late part of the mid-1940s. It was called the International Waffen-SS, where the bankers behind the Nazi system were going to replace the Wehrmacht finally and totally with an international SS, the International Waffen-SS, which is what Michael Ledeen represents in his proposals today. This is the kind of thing we're dealing with. This is the enemy of civilization. We must destroy it. Now, what happened? Israel did not start this current war. Yeah, there's a war situation that's going on there in the region of Southwest Asia for a long time. Cheney did, and Bush did. Cheney didn't dream it up. They're the instruments which are used to launch it. The Israeli generals, the Israeli leaders, the senior ones, know this is crap. They know what the Israeli government and others are saying about this situation is crap. The Hezbollah is not going to be puffed away in a short period of time. We're looking at generalized irregular warfare throughout the entire region. There is no solution in Iraq. Iraq will not be solved for a long time to come. The United States has made an unholy mess of Iraq, which cannot be repaired for some time to come. Afghanistan, which we went into first, is now far worse, far more menacing than it ever was before. We have the spread of chaos throughout the world, bloody chaos. You're looking at something like the beginning, the onset of a new dark age. And some people wish to bring it on. This is what my Israeli friend said. He said there's no likelihood that anybody would be involved in extending this war, which is being conducted nominally by Israel now, but which is actually Israel is doing under orders from Cheney and company and Bush, not on their own volition. That's why they're shutting up. They're shutting up about the facts. They know the facts. They know the situation is hopeless. They know what apart from all the propaganda, they know what the forces are involved in southern Lebanon. They know the correlation of forces in the Middle East. This is insane. It is absolutely insane for Israel to be involved in that kind of war. It means the destruction of Israel and everything around it in a fairly short order. Why do they do it? They're doing it because they're being pressured to do it. And the pressure comes normally through stupid Bush, who's a psychotic, and Cheney, who's a sociopath. But it's coming from higher levels, typified by the bankers who were associated with Felix Rouhani. And therefore, we're at a point where the problem we have with the Senate is sophistry. And the sophistry problem is what I've described. It's the baby boomer generation, the golden generation type of sophistry. And therefore, they don't accept reality. They reject reality because they assume that their will, the will, like Hitler, the will. As at a Nuremberg rally, the will. The all-powerful will do everything for us. It is our will that it will happen. That's where it will happen. We will. We have agreed that this will happen. We in the Senate have agreed. We in the House have agreed, except for a few holdouts. Therefore, it will happen because we have agreed. Heil Hitler. What's the difference? The act of the will. The triumph of will. I believe. I don't care what the truth is. I believe. I don't care what you say. I believe. Like a fundamentalist rally. I believe. They're worshiping Satan. I believe in Christ. Why do you believe in Satan then? Why do you serve Satan? You say, well, I'm all for the Jews. Why? Because we're going to kill them. Tim LaHaye. When we get in power, we're going to give them one chance. You either join, you become a Christian now, or we shoot you, or something else. The most vicious anti-Semites on this planet are called Zionists. Tim LaHaye. Now, this is the problem, is we don't have rationality, and we... who fight as for the tradition of the lower 80% of the population, we find ourselves outnumbered by the upper 20%. We produce, you just produce. We are the ones who get the pensions. We get the golden parachutes. We are the important people. What do? Oh, we take the money. Oops. This is what you're dealing with. So the problem here essentially is these poor fellows, these baby boomers, because they're sophists, do not believe in the soul. They may have thought they sold it for something or other. Went out with the garbage, went out with a bag full of garbage. They don't believe that they have an immortality. They don't believe that they're accountable to past and future generations. They don't believe that their pleasure in what they get physically is not the end of life. Animals get that. You want to become an animal? Okay, become an animal. Take your citizenship card, tear it up. I'm not a citizen anymore. I'm an animal. Turn yourself into the Animal Rescue League. If you're a human being, then you have a moral responsibility which is innate in the fact that you're a human being. And as you say in religion, you are out to save your soul. That's what you do things for. You don't have to be religious in the formal sense of being a member of this or that religion. You have to know that's what's essential. You do it because it's the right thing to do. You risk your life because it's the right thing to do. You take the pain because it's the right thing to do. You take the risk because it's the right thing to do. How the devil do you think we got this far in the United States? How do you think we got through Hitler and got through the other problems we've had? Except by people who took that and who concentrated on trying to inspire and encourage other people to do likewise. It was always a minority of the total population that was the fighting edge of mankind and everything good that happened. But much of the rest of the mankind would follow along and take the benefit and say, hey, this is good. I've got to try to be something like that myself. So you have, it's inspiring people to understand and find their morality. And I admit it's very difficult to get a baby boomer to accept morality because they have a completely different agenda. But you have a few people like Bill Clinton and others who are worth saving and should be saved and must be saved in the sense that these people are baby boomers who can face up to the reality of their guilt and do have a higher sense of morality, a commitment to do something for their future while they're still alive, something for the future of mankind while they're still alive, and face the reality of the challenge and the risks we face in doing that. And that's what's lacking. And thus what's happened is you've got to come to a point, a watershed. We're at a point where by approximately September, forecasting is not predicting. It's not predicting something's going to happen in a mechanical, statistical way. But approximately September, as it stands now, you can expect the whole system to come down the way it's going now. It's finished. And most people in high places around the world who are in this area would tend to agree with me. Yeah, you're right. You're probably right. This we're worried about. We're getting that in Russia. We're getting it in Europe and so forth. They're all these financial circles are saying, look, the system, it can't go on like this. The system is about to come down. And it'll probably come down about September. Plus or minus, who knows? There can be changes. But that's the kind, that's the war situation. You're up at a point where you must estimate. We have to be prepared for the expectation that the system will come down in September. Maybe it won't, maybe it will. Maybe it'll come on down later. If there's a change for the better, it might not come down. I could fix it. I could fix this thing. If I were president of the United States, I could deal with it. This jerk couldn't, of course. Right? But that's where we stand. Therefore, the enemy knows that too. The people behind this stupid jerk, Felix Wahadin, know it too. They know that approximately that time, they've got to figure the system will come down then. Their issue is they want to get control of the world through chaos by the time the crash occurs, to make sure that no Franklin Roosevelt or his like would intervene as Roosevelt intervened in early March of 1933 to respond to a general crash of the world system with initiatives from the United States, which in fact could save the world from hell. And that's what the issue is. And that's what my Israeli friend's problem was, what he said, is that if the war is coming soon, if the breakdown of the system is coming soon, then what is happening with the United States pushing Israel into a war which the Israeli leaders, at least all the same ones, know is an insane project, well, then that's almost inevitable. We've got to stop it. We'll only stop it by making clear what the issue is. This is not an Israeli issue. This is an issue of Felix Rohatyn and what he represents, the people behind poor, stupid Bush and Cheney. They're the ones who are pushing this war. They're pushing Israel on a suicide mission for the greater glory of Cheney and Felix Rotten. And we got to stop it. And therefore, we need people in the Congress and elsewhere who have the guts to give up this sophistry of theirs and face the facts about the economy and about the system and be prepared to join us and do what is necessary. I know what to do to deal with this financial crisis. I know exactly what to do. And that's what I'm prepared to see done. I need their permission to do it. She was here.
She's here.
Everybody can feel free to stretch their legs for 2 minutes. Debbie will be back very soon and has a whole series of questions, and we'll also obviously start taking a list of names of people here in the room who also may have questions to ask Mr. LaRouche. And here she is.
Lynn is so sneaky. I thought he was going to keep talking. Okay, well, let me just go through with people, because I know there are some new people here, the general procedure with questions. As always, people can submit questions via email, those of you who are listening on the World Wide Web. For people who are here with us, you can either write your question out and I will read it for you, or you can simply indicate that you do have a question and I will call you up to the mic. I would ask that people simply, either way, indicate their name and who and what they represent. We also have a series of questions that were submitted by various institutions here in Washington, and I will ask those as well. And I'll try to take as many of the questions that come forward as I possibly can. Lynn, the first question actually comes from someone who directs one of the progressive think tanks here in Washington. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, I was familiar with your organization long before I came to Washington to try to affect national policy. In fact, although I was never prepared to fully commit, I was on the fringes of your organization during a good portion of my college years. That's really being charitable in describing his position. He says, back then, you were harshly critical of people like George McGovern and Gene McCarthy. Yet today, it does in fact seem that they are both counted among your friends. My question is, has your view of that period changed, or have you simply decided to put differences aside for the sake of a greater good? I ask the question not simply out of personal interest, but I ask it because it seems to me that if there is any way that we are going to make it through the current period, that people are going to have to take what are minor differences and put them aside in the interest of a greater national interest.
Well, in that period of time, I was in a right, but I also did not disregard the personal merit of people like Gene McCarthy and McGovern. But they were wrong in their policy, because they were in a sense, trying to adapt to the Democratic Party. Well, Gene less so, George more so. But trying to adapt to the Democratic Party framework. Now, Gene was going outside the party largely in his presidential campaign. So it's a different case. And he was blocked out quite successfully in a sense. But his position was clear. And at that time, I had no real disagreement with Gene McCarthy. But the point, what I saw was the Democratic Party was headed toward hell. It was headed toward hell, especially in the post-Kennedy period, by trying to adapt to the 68er phenomenon. And I knew what the 68er phenomenon was. For example, I wrote a paper, a short paper, in June of 1968, having just observed the events, among others, at Columbia University during the spring. And the paper was entitled Social Control and Fascism. Local control and fascism. Because what I saw in the second demonstration of the uprising at Columbia University and similar locations, I saw what was called the mathematics or RIM 2. I saw fascism. It was nakedly out there in terms of the 68er generation. The first one, the first strike at Columbia was the one character. But then what happened is the people behind the Congress for Cultural Freedom moved in, corrupted and brought in other elements, and they staged a second strike of no purpose, which was in the spirit of violence. And I watched what they were doing. And I said, this is fascism. This is exactly what we saw on the streets of Berlin in the relevant period in the early 1930s. So I wrote this thing on fascism. And that point, the point I recognized is the Democratic Party. We saw that in the 68ers generally. The 68er movement was essentially sociologically and intellectually a fascist movement. Now, McGovern got in on the idea of trying to deal with certain tendencies in the party and regroup the tendencies, regroupment of forces around issues. I was opposed to that because here we had the greatest financial crisis since the Depression, had just struck. In 71, I had just dealt with the thing. I'd forecast this thing. I knew it. I understood its implications. And McGovern was adapting to these layers on a sort of a coalition within the Democratic Party, which I knew was a loser. And it was more the most important thing at that time was to fight these tendencies, not to say, let's try to build a coalition around them. Don't try to build ourselves into a corrupt organization. Because what this country needs now is leadership away from this direction. And you're not going to give leadership of any worth anything against this direction, which we've gone into, unless you oppose this. So I opposed it. McGovern, I respect it as a person. But he was on the wrong tactic. And that's what the problem was. That's often the case in life. You've got somebody who's a decent fellow, wants to win the right war, but he's got the wrong general, and he's fighting the wrong war, not the war he thinks he's fighting. But he's compromising with forces which are going to lead to his destruction. Look what happened in France in 1940. The French were under the leadership of a fascist government. The fascist government wanted the German army to conquer France. The problem was that the French army, the French military, was more powerful than the German military. So therefore, the only way they could get the German military to conquer France is by treason inside the French command. And the treason inside the French command let the German military come through in a known area, just as in the First World War, come through and outflank the French forces and put corrupt generals in the command of certain divisions, move the wrong troops, good troops in the wrong place, and the bad troops in the wrong place. So you put poor troops where the fight was going to be on, and you put the troops who are capable of fighting in places where the conflict was going to be less. And you kept the door wide open for this flanking maneuver by the Wehrmacht. And the Wehrmacht came in with a flanking maneuver and a fifth column inside the French government. So therefore, in these kinds of situations, You have to think about winning the war. When you run a campaign, you run a campaign to win the war. See, people will say to me, why don't you just try to not make so much, be so stiff in the Democratic Party? Why do you demand that they listen to you so much? Why don't you just quietly accept and work your way in there and be accepted? I say, bullshit. I know what to do and you don't. Now, come on. You're supposed to have brains. You're supposed to recognize that I'm right and you're wrong. Come on. Wise up.
I keep trying to explain to people that when I talk like that, I'm just quoting my boss. It's true. Oh, boy. Then this is actually, you'll recognize who the question is from when I ask it. He currently is a university professor, but he was in Washington not too long ago. He says, Mr. LaRouche, I have a couple of questions or points of clarification about your recent statements regarding the infrastructure policy that Felix Rohatyn has proposed. Let me preface my questions by saying that I locked horns with Mr. Rohatyn over questions of economic policy back during the first Clinton administration, and it was a very unpleasant encounter. My question, though, is this. Is your disagreement with Rohatyn's infrastructure proposal actually based on the proposal itself or by what you believe is behind the proposal? The second part of my question is related but a little bit different, and I think I know the answer to it, but I still would like to hear it from you, because some have taken your recent statements as supporting an argument that the government has to do it all, essentially as a transformation to what's commonly referred to as a command economy, if you will. However, my distinct recollection was that during Ron Brown's service as Secretary of Commerce, when Ron worked to put together a public-private consortium for reconstruction in the Balkans and also for the construction of nuclear energy facilities in China, you were generally supportive of those efforts. I'd like you to explain a little bit more some of the way these issues are posed.
Yeah. Well, my opposition to Rohatyn is twofold. First of all, he's a Nazi. No, that simple. And his infrastructure policy for the United States is that. Now, there's a book was written by a gentleman from Massachusetts called The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which describes exactly Rohatyn's policy in these confessions and describes them as the policies of people like George Shultz and company. Now, the question is what do we mean by infrastructure? What Rohatyn does, he preys upon people who don't really understand economics in principle. They may understand something about economics, but they don't understand how an economic system works. An economic system works upon, first of all, the typical training in economics, even among people who I respect as doing good work in economics, is they think in terms of statistical mechanics of monetary procedures and things attached to it. They don't think of a dynamic system. And social processes are dynamic systems, like living systems. They are not statistical mechanic systems. Therefore, you cannot argue the merits of something by itself on the basis of, is this a good product or not? In the case of the economic hitmen, the point was that many of the projects that were put in were based on good ideas of infrastructure as such. But with the way the thing was structured was such that the very idea of having this dam or having this other project, was being used to indebt the country to wreck it and to conquer it and ruin it, which was done to various countries in South and Central America, Asia, and so forth. It's typical. So therefore, you have to think about how the whole process is done. Now, we're talking in government control. Under our system, there's a certain element of that has to be government control. unlike European systems, which are not really civilized, the American system is based on a principle in the Constitution that the federal government, with the consent of the Congress, has the power to utter currency. No other agency has the power to utter currency. Thus, under the U.S. Constitution, when followed, and the U.S. Constitution is not merely a code of law, it's the definition of a system of economy, and was designed as such, as a system of economy, not as some kind of a legal partnership agreement or something. Therefore, the U.S. government has the unique power over the utterance and management of its currency. Congress. Huh? Congress role. That means that the Congress votes up a bill which authorizes the federal government, through the Department of the Treasury, to utter currency. Now, this utterance of currency may occur simply as a simple direct utterance of currency, as greenbacks on the street, or it may occur simply as a transfer of federal credit through various banking institutions and other special institutions to fund projects with federal credit, such as large-scale infrastructure projects in particular, or also to provide credit to private enterprises which the government feels are in the vital interests of the nation. We're now in a period in which there is the whole banking system, European and American banking system, is hopelessly bankrupt. There's no possible way that the banking system as it presently operates could continue to operate on its own. Right? Therefore, what is needed right now is the federal government must take the Federal Reserve System into receivership in bankruptcy, because the Federal Reserve System, as representing its constituent elements, including its private elements, is now hopelessly bankrupt. Therefore, we face a situation in which we must protect the stability of U.S. society and the U.S. economy and the financial system as such. Therefore, the federal government must put the Federal Reserve System into bankruptcy, into receivership. Now, in Europe, that can't be done, because in Europe, the governments are subject to control by private banking interests called independent central banking systems. European economy, European economics, what is called as Keynesian economics included, is nothing but a a feudal society in which private interests, as typified by ancient Venetian cartels or by the Lombard League, which went down in the Dark Ages, the 13th century, these institutions have the power to regulate government and to dictate terms to government, and the government obeys, usually. There are exceptions, of course, but generally that's the case. In the U.S. Constitution, the banking system must submit to the government in the matter of the government's authority, which is constitutional in respect to currency and federal credit and regulation of the banking system. Now, we have a situation where the private banking system is hopelessly bankrupt. There's no way this private banking system, as it presently exists, could continue to exist much longer. It's ready to blow in a hyperinflationary explosion, which you see reflected in part in the hyperinflation in primary materials such as petroleum, metals, and so forth. It's gone. It's finished. Over. So therefore, if we're going to save the economy, save the nation, prevent chaos, the federal government must now act to put the Federal Reserve System into bankruptcy receivership and take control and management of it under law to prevent chaos. Because we're going to have to freeze this, we're going to have to freeze that, cut that out, do this and so forth. We must keep the level of employment and production up. We cannot allow anything to break down that's essential. And that becomes the primary responsibility of the federal government. Now, this is always implicit. It's implicit from the beginning of our nation. The idea of the Hamiltonian system is that the federal government is responsible, through the Treasury Department and through its obligation to the Congress, to regulate the currency and to manage its utterance and the creation of federal credit which can be converted into currency through the banking system. That we must have an objective where we decide what are the goals of the nation, what has to be done to the nation as a dynamic system to keep the nation together. The basic problem we have yet in the United States is we have a breakdown in our basic economic infrastructure. Since approximately 1970, 1971, actually since about 1969, we've had a breakdown in the maintenance of the essential basic economic economy, the basic infrastructure. River systems, power systems, everything is broken down. Healthcare systems, all broken down. It's not the healthcare system that's failed, it's the government that has deliberately sabotaged the process and broken the thing down since the Nixon administration was responsible for putting through the HMO legislation. Okay? So therefore, we have to fix things that have been broken by neglect or otherwise over the past period. We must have a functional economy. We must have health care for our people. We must have education. We must have combat against disease. We must have water management. Without these things, the private economy doesn't work. Now, the infrastructure portion of the economy is about 50% of the total economy if we calculate it in terms of requirements. Therefore, the federal government has to follow somewhat like a Kennedy policy, a John F. Kennedy policy, which is the last time the U.S. government was moving in this kind of direction, was under Kennedy. Where he challenged the steel bosses, who subsequently rewarded him by shutting down the steel industry. So therefore, we have to have the public sector driving the economy with things like space project. We got 10 cents back on every penny we spent on NASA in terms of technology spilling over with benefits into the economy in general. So therefore, we have to take those kinds of things, including education that's related to that. We have to push these things that will drive the economic potential of the nation higher. We emphasize particularly the machine tool sector, which is the driver for all technological progress in industry and agriculture and other things. So these things must be priorities. We must then find people who are entrepreneurs in the private sector. We must promote their activity by where they can prove themselves to a reasonable bunch of people in the locality that they're competent. We will get them credit and give them a chance to succeed, because we need to have them succeed. We need to shift this economy back from a so-called service economy orientation to a productive economy orientation. We have a vast amount of people who are becoming useless people. We don't count them. We write them off the list. They're nowhere near a productive job. They're nowhere near the kind of employment and careers where they can survive and raise a family into their later years. So therefore, these kinds of objectives have to be our primary objectives. And so therefore, the idea of command economy, this is gobbledygook, which is spread by people like people from the Sidney Hook's friends, for example, Congress of Cultural Freedom. Of the Congress for Cultural Obscenity. This is what the problem is. And therefore, what you have to understand is that infrastructure is the territory of the nation as a whole. The improvement of the territory of the nation as a whole, which means water systems, water projects, power systems, everything. It means we need a high technology orientation. This must be calculated at about 50% of the total annual expenditure of the United States government. On current account. Capital account may be larger. Then we must promote also a reversal of the trend away from productive employment into so-called services economy. We must look at the percentage of our population which is being thrown into the waste basket, especially young people who are being destroyed, thrown into the waste basket. We must get them integrated into the process and back into the productive system. We must educate them. We must give them job opportunities. And this has to be an integrated policy. The freedom comes in the expression of creativity. That the object of wise government will give bright young people a promise and commitment, every possible chance to succeed, and will create the opportunities for them to succeed. So our country is not a free trade society. Hopefully not. Our economy is a land of opportunity for everyone. And the private sector is essentially the primary land of opportunity, where people are able to express their freedom in life by doing good for society and encouraged to do so. and have a future and have honor, in which the people who do this work in the private sector find that the necessary infrastructure is next door, waiting for them to support the local industry. So the problem is people do not understand this. And therefore, what they do is they get taken in by people like Wahatan, who's a complete swindler and liar. Wahatan doesn't know anything about economy. He's a loan shark. That's essentially what he is. He's an organized crime loan shark. That's his career profile. And he lies. And he works for an organization which was created, the Nazi system, which is still the same organization. The personnel have changed through attrition of years. But he's still a Nazi. He's part of a Nazi system. You want him in? You want him in our society, running our society? You want him taking away the functions of government and taking them over and saying who lives and dies according to what his private holdings decide? That's fascism.
Lynn, the next question is from a Democratic senator. He says, Mr. LaRouche, I don't know if your D.C. audience is aware of it, but right now about one-third the city of New York is in a state of shutdown. Basically, the current heat wave has led to a severe overload of the city's energy grid. The problem is not simply expressed as rolling brownouts, as have occurred in the past, but fires are currently breaking out along power lines that are ancient, decayed, and overloaded. The resultant damage will not be easily repaired. While I'm principally concerned with my home state, I suspect that this is not a unique circumstance. In fact, I need only read reports of the continued problems in New Orleans to be convinced that much of what you say about the current infrastructure crisis in the United States is true. My question is this. While I understand your overall position that broader questions of the organization of the financial system have to be addressed, why not simply go with a straightforward, basic infrastructure bill and just pose that to both Democrats and Republicans, since it seems very hard to deny the nature of the problem. They probably are more likely to agree with that than they are prepared to take on larger questions of global finance.
Well, I wouldn't be opposed to such emergency legislation, but it won't work in the long run unless you do something else as well. The problem, New York got into the mess, which Rahatan made worse, and really worse, because he's a thug. He stole. His crowd stole. Is New York had a certain character going into the World War II period. And coming out of the World War II period, there was a process immediately which started with Levittown, is that you had a city which was decaying in many aspects and so regions, whether housing and so forth had been decaying. It had been primarily, remember, New York had been the leading industrial city of the United States. And this was destroyed in the post-war period. Now, in the earlier period, New York, with all its faults, had been built up on the basis of its role as chiefly an industrial power, an industrial state. Not as a commercial state, not as a financial community, but as an industrial state. So you saw the breakdown in several ways. First of all, you had the failure to renew urban infrastructure. Secondly, you had a destruction of the industrial character of the region. And then you had, of course, a complication, is the tax revenue base struggle was corrupt as hell because the financier interests of the city pulled a vast swindle. And an associate of mine and I did some work on this. I'm going back to the history of titles, of land titles and property titles and mortgages in New York City. We went through this thing. New York real estate was a bubble, a vast swindle. And the people who lived in New York were paying for that swindle. So the people who should have been taxed on the basis of the swindle they were pulling were not taxed. The renewal which should have occurred was not made. The industrial renewal which should have occurred was not made. So therefore, as I said before Rohatyn got in there, in testimony I gave before a New York City Council meeting, I said, you guys have got to wake up. The city is going to revolt against you. You're making promises and you're not delivering. Conditions are becoming worse and you're not correcting them. You're making policies and proposals on the basis of things that you say will be good, but you don't back it up. So therefore, the people of New York are subjected to promises but no performance. And you're going to face a crisis very soon as a result of this. And they faced a crisis. But instead of fixing the crisis, they did the worst possible thing. They went Rohatyn's way. They should have gone exactly the opposite way. And you look at the way Victor Gottbaum operated and other things operated in Big Mac. It was a pure swindle. The people of New York City were swindled. The state of New York was swindled. The government of New York City was swindled by Felix Rohatyn and his backers. Now today, so therefore, we have two problems. Yes, you have an emergency. It's like a forest fire emergency, as you describe. I'm not surprised. We're going to have this in many parts of the country. We have a general breakdown of power facilities and many other things, water facilities. Look, take the New York City municipal water system. How about that? Look down in the drains. Look down at the piping. What's coming through? Think back to the day where you could turn the faucet on and get drinkable water out of the faucet. Look around the country for places where you can still get drinkable water out of the faucet if you don't mind a worm or two. So the point is, yes, emergency legislation, if you can get it through, get it through. Because you have to make the repair. But the repair is a relatively shorter-term problem. Now you have to find out how you're going to pay for sustaining the repairs. Therefore, you have to build a system. The problem here is a generic one for the nation. We have been going to a post-industrial society. Look at the ratio of people, what they're employed in. Look at the lack of capital investment per capita. Look at the breakdown in levels of technology per capita. There's no way this United States economy can function as it's functioning. It has been destroyed by the 68ers. It has been destroyed by post-industrial ideology and its application and by financial swindles. We're going to have to rebuild it like it used to be or better. And therefore, what you need is a 30 to 50 year kind of investment program, which is going to bring the factors into balance, the factors which expend what must be expended to maintain the population and meet needs, but also which will generate the income which enables from the private consumption and expenditure and public consumption, the money will be there. The support will be there in terms of generated income to enable us to continue to make these projects going. The mistake is when you come in with an improvement, I'm going to give you this nice thing in this city. Who is going to pay for it? Well, we'll give you a loan. But who's going to repay the loan with the interest on it? Where is the industry, where is the income that's going to support the support of this debt? So therefore, in the short term, yes, it's right to have the debt. It must be fixed for human reasons. But you must also think at the same time of another category of action, a larger one, which creates the structure under which the continued financing of this process is generated through expansion of production and employment in that region.
Once again, for those of you who are listening via the internet, you're listening to an address broadcast from Washington, D.C., by the international economist and statesman Lyndon LaRouche. I'd like to, before I ask the next question, recognize a new audience for today's webcast. It is my understanding that that this webcast is being broadcast at the San Simon University in Cochabamba, Bolivia. This is a public university and one of the three most important universities in the nation of Bolivia. As far as I know, we have never had a formal audience for one of these webcasts in that country, and therefore I'd like to welcome them to the network that listens to and participates in these events internationally. Okay, the next question is from it's from a democratic consultant. He says, Lynn, I probably should be better able to answer this question than you, but the fact is that in spite of having spent a lot of sleepless nights trying to do just that, I failed. My question is this. Beginning with Barbara Boxer's support of the Ohio delegation's efforts to protect the vote, up through the fight to defeat the nuclear option and to stop the privatization of Social Security, I could say without reservation that I was proud to call myself a Democrat. But somehow, things really started to fall apart around the time that the Senate was considering the Alito nomination. And today, we seem to be right back where we were the day after John Kerry prematurely conceded the presidential election to George Bush. Some could argue that we're actually in worse shape then because we actually proved during the Social Security fight that we could win a fight despite having a minority of votes in the Senate. My question is really a very simple one. What happened?
Well, what happened essentially was Felix Rohatyn. On May 1st of last year, at the time I was proposing the follow-up to the then ongoing fight to save Social Security, Felix Rohatyn had moved in. And we found that when I was warning of the auto crisis, that the federal government had to act immediately to save not only the auto industry, but to save the U.S. economy. The Democrats and others were shifting away from me on that. Well, sounds a little leftist to us, you know. Where was this coming from? It was coming from Felix Rohatyn. And, of course, a few senators like Senators Dodd and a few others of that type in the Senate. So, therefore, these guys, being what they are, backed away. And they backed away more and more. They began to look at the proposal for dealing with the auto crisis as, well, a good thing to be on record as supporting, but not a life and death issue, a gut issue for the nation of immediate urgency. And therefore, they backed more and more away. Now, when we went into the Nancy Pelosi's address at Harvard University, there was still a commitment to a technological driver orientation of the Democratic Party, particularly for the Senate, but also in the House. By mid-February, the time the Alito nomination issue was up, that had been dropped. A complete back-off on all of the issues. The Democratic Party had gone over in certain large parts to the Felix Rohatyn crowd, the Nazis, to put the plain name on it. So people have to reckon with their conscience on this one. Now, you know how these things work. people belong to certain religious denominations, certain Freemasonic clubs, and other things of that type. And they depend upon this for their re-election or whatever, and other effect, pressures on the family, pressures on this kind of circle. And over a Christmas, New Year's year-end, they can get beaten up back home by the local boys working them over in a coordinated way and say, Felix Rotten says this, this guy says this. You know Lieberman was against it. We know Dodd was against it. And the sabotage was going on. Howard Dean was against it. Howard Dean was very unhappy with what we were doing. Huh? And Howard Dean and George Soros and Felix Rohatyn are pretty much the same thing. And Dean is the leader of the Democratic Campaign Organization, which is a big mistake anyway. I mean, a guy who has a nervous breakdown in public in the middle of a presidential campaign is not the desirable leader of a national political party. But such is life. So it's that simple. Now, the point is people think there's a certain go-along-to-get-along policy in the Senate in particular, the Democratic Party in particular. And therefore, when a bunch of people get together and say, well, this is our club, these are some ideas, interesting ideas. Yeah, we may kind of use them in the year, two years from now after the next presidential election. But you know, let's not get too hard on this thing. You know, Felix doesn't like it. We want to keep party unity. We want to keep unity with certain cooperation with certain Republicans and so forth. Come on, let's, go along to get along. Go to hell to get to hell. And the only way you can deal with this in history, the only way, you've got to realize there's one value which comes above all other values, and that is truth. Stop lying. Stop saying you believe in something and then vote against it. Huh? Stop saying, yes, I agree with you, but we had to do this. Well, I know the guy was innocent, but we had to send him to the electric chair because I didn't want to quarrel among the family. It's a fair mistake. It's moral rottenness, and the problem is the sophistry. The baby boomer generation, especially those who were educated in this upper 20%, the Ivy League influenced modalities of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, that's the rot in our society. That's the Delphic curse in our society, which corrupts, you know, as they say, fish steaks from the head from the upper 20% of the population.
Now, the next question is from one of the national directors of MoveOn. Mr. LaRouche, he says, first, although this is certainly not the position of MoveOn, I'd like to personally commend you, indeed to thank you for everything you've done, especially since the convention in Boston. Taking note of what you did there and what you did afterward, I decided to pursue a better understanding of your ideas. And since then, I've engaged in a lively and perhaps at times contentious dialogue with your representative. She's usually very patient about answering my questions. But there is one thing that I've noticed in your recent statements that I've not had the opportunity to ask. And this regards your view of what occurred in the United States in the post-World War II period. I happen to agree with you that we suffered a terrible loss when Franklin Delano Roosevelt died. But I'd like you to say more about why you have such a negative view of Harry Truman, whom most Democrats hold in such very high regard.
Well... You know, I, of course, I answered this in part today earlier on Truman. I would also say that some people are maybe not by intention, but otherwise strongly attached to their habitual diseases. And the belief that Truman is a great Democrat is a typical sophist rumor, which has the quality of being a disease. This guy was a real bum. And he, as I said the other day in the Ninth, you know, when they took one smell of him, when they total up the score, they say, "Git! You git! He stink!" And they got him out, you know, being the Democratic Party, they got him out of there in a discreet way. Go home. They let him wander the streets of New York for a while and express his opinions, you know, these daily walks. He's jauntily walking up and down the street, up towards Central Park, along Fifth Avenue, similar kinds of places, or Sixth Avenue. And, but he stunk. And his daughter didn't sing too well either. So, it's just a fact of life. There's nothing, just the fact that people revere something. You know, look at obesity in the U.S. population. Why do people become obese? Well, sometimes there are reasons, medical reasons. Sometimes it's because of the habits, and they won't give up the habits. Or they live in the wrong neighborhood, or they eat in the wrong joints, or they don't have enough money to buy a decent diet, and therefore they try to get the energy to go along by taking fatty foods of the type that we're stuffing into our children these days. The cheap foods which are flavored to attract children and make them expand. So they get a wide view of life. So this is the case of Truman. I have no apology for what I say about Truman. It's factually true. The guy's a bum. I could also talk about some other bums in the presidency. You got two guys. You got Teddy Roosevelt, who was not only the nephew of the head of the Confederate Intelligence Service, but was trained by him and acted accordingly as president. You had Woodrow Wilson, who was a lifelong supporter of the Ku Klux Klan, and who from the White House itself launched the mass organizing of the Klan again during World War I period and during the 1920s. Now, he's an old goodnik. Coolidge shut up because he had the sense not to let people know what he was saying. Hoover was not a bad guy, but he was under the control of people who owned him. And therefore, he was a house servant of Andrew Mellon. He was not an independent figure as president. And Truman was a bum, too. Carter didn't know what the presidency was, but he was president. Nixon was no good, but many of the people around him were worse. Reagan had a good side to him, but he also had a susceptible side to him. George H.W. Bush, of course, being the son of the guy who helped put Hitler into power, is not the greatest authority on morals and American interests. And his son is an idiot, which he came by honestly. So Clinton is a great guy. Personally, I didn't like many of the things he did. I thought they were mistakes, but he's a great guy personally. And I hope we can find a great guy who also will not make many mistakes as the next president.
After this question, I will actually start to entertain some questions from the audience. This is a question that came in from a senior staffer to a Democratic congressman who also serves on the staff of the Progressive Caucus. She says, "Mr. LaRouche, I am extremely distressed by the unanimous passage of the resolution in support of Israel and by what I also expect will be overwhelming support for that same measure in the House of Representatives. While nobody would argue that a nation, Israel or any other, has a right to defend itself against terrorism, I cannot abide by what is currently going on. The Israelis are bombing a sovereign nation that has committed no crime against them. I also don't understand how destroying the Beirut airport will stop Hezbollah. In my mind, what's happening couldn't be clearer. The administration wanted to open up a new front in their global war by bombing Iran, and they were turned back. For a while, they played around with the prospect of war against North Korea, but it seemed that there was no appetite for that. Now they've given Israel a green light to start a new war, which I expect will spread to Iran and Syria. I simply cannot believe that not a single Democratic U.S. senator would stand up and simply say that. Up until this week, I was still fairly optimistic that the Democratic Party would do the right thing. But the fact is that if they would stand silent simply for fear of angering the Zionist lobby prior to an electoral campaign when they are going to ask them for money, well, I just don't know what to say. Right now, I'm seriously considering resigning my post, although I really need this job. My question to you is this. Is it too late for the Democratic Party? And even though I know all of the problems that are contained in this idea, has the time come when we have to think about a third-party option in the United States?
Well, there is obviously a case for a prospective change in the composition somewhat of the party alignments in two ways. First of all, parties sometimes are exaggerated in their significance. They are not really, they don't have airtight integrity, though they like to pretend they do. At least the leadership likes to control the membership, so they pretend that this is an airtight organization which is run from the top down. Some trade unions have the same problem. They sort of become a bureaucracy which sits on the membership rather than being a servant of the organization. But there several things are obvious. First of all, United States policy should not be party policy. It should be United States policy. And parties should be instruments in the process of shaping that policy, not dictators of the policy, not one party, winner take all, as was we had recently under the Bush administration, particularly after the first midterm election after that. No, that's wrong. But there obviously, there between certain Republicans and other Republicans, there is a deep gulf, moral and otherwise. And there are several subdivisions of that. There is a vast part of the U.S. population which has no attachment to any party. And some of these are large constituencies which really don't have much, any strong attachment to any party, though they may meddle with a bunch of them. They don't trust any of them. So therefore, the time has come for a realignment of politics. And because of the nature of things, it means that it probably will have to be an evolution which functions in terms of some rescrambling of the structure of the two leading parties. I think we could have, you know, the fascist Republicans can go off in one direction, the fascist Democrats can go off another direction, the honest Republicans and honest Democrats can go off another direction, and somehow in that process and with the process of election of representatives at the state level, we can make something out of this mess. But the problem here essentially is to have a principled policy. Now, when you're running something like a campaign for selling merchandise through public relations stunts, you don't get good politics. You have to start and say, what is the interest of the nation? What is overall must we do now? What must we do in the world? What should our policy about the world? How are we going to live in the world? What are we going to work with? And start from that and then take in that context, look at many of the regional and local issues. Let's take, for example, a concrete question. The question of the Mexico elections. Now, I did not stick my snout into the presidential campaign in Mexico City when I was in Monterrey. And I was very explicit about why I didn't do that. Now I stick my snout into the situation. Why? Because a fraud has been created. Election fraud has been created. We have in the United States a very large Mexican-American population. Many citizens, many non-citizens. Many legals, some illegals. Millions of illegals, too. Now, the illegals of Mexico, as Mexicans, largely come from sections of Mexico which are suffering from the lack of opportunity created by a coup which was run by the United States government against President López Portillo at the end of López Portillo's tenure as president. So therefore, we have now got the largest single designated minority in the United States. Minority group is Mexican-Americans of all these categories, citizens and non-citizens, the largest single group. We have across the border, we have the same population largely from northern Mexico, the agricultural regions of the northern states of Mexico, which are now being hit by this, and Mexico as a whole is being hit by this. And what happens to us in the United States if with the insanity on this, of these right-wing bills on border bills, combined with producing a fascist-like turmoil and instability in Mexico below the border, what is going to happen inside the United States? Therefore, we as American citizens must have a policy about Mexico. It's not a party policy, though the party should take a position on this. Other groups should take a position. We have our strongest reaction on this is in the state of California, where we have a significant responsibility in the Democratic Party, and where there's a large concentration of Mexican-American citizens and non-citizens, legals, illegals, all there. And many of them are the same families that are represented in northern Mexico. We want to have a crisis in northern Mexico? With a crisis already here in the United States in terms of the living conditions of the people in the lower 80% of family income brackets? With a racist atmosphere being built up around this border bill by the Bush administration? You want that? Democratic Party, you want that? You want the largest single minority. Now you've estranged the African-American minority totally. They're going over to Republicans for the money being offered. You want the whole United States torn apart from the inside because you're negligent on this issue? Because the Bush administration has played a role in taking a guy who has fascist credentials, Calderon, that is of the Syndicates International, an organization which was brought into Mexico from Nazi headquarters in Berlin, and which is a part of the same fact that went into Chile and the Operation Condor in the Southern Cone under the benefit of Felix Rohatyn, George Shultz, and Henry Kissinger. You want that? So these are the kinds of problems that come up which distinguish the men from the boys. The parties have to face up to the sociological reality of the conditions of life which threaten the great majority of our population. And large population, parts of the population which are called minority population, as this affects relations with other nations, especially neighboring nations, is of crucial importance. And when a party fails to step up to the line on these kinds of issues, we have to, for example, we have to bring, if possible, unity. And this is where the Democratic Party should be acting. We have to bring unity among the African-American, so-called, and the Hispanic-American, the two largest minorities in the United States, as indicated minorities, together around the party, not for particularist issues, but for the issue of the benefit of the nation as a whole. The key thing with these groups, which are treated as minority groups, is they are citizens of the United States or would like to become citizens of the United States. And therefore, our willingness to enable them to participate in an efficient way in shaping national policy is a test of whether we're going to have a nation or not, whether we're going to have a republic anymore. So the key thing is we have to have a question about what is the best way to represent our functional interests as a republic. And let the parties develop around those ideas. Let the differences which may occur around the, let them be expressed. But let them be expressed with the view that we go into the functions of government and we fight out and develop a unified policy for the nation on these issues.
We do have some more institutional questions, but I'm going to start mixing in now questions from people who are here with us and also some of the questions that are coming in via the internet, so that if people wish to submit questions and have not done so already, you still have time to do that. Lynn, there's a question from Senator Neal of Nevada. Where is he? Do you want me to read this, or do you want to come up to the mic?
You go ahead and read.
Okay.
You go ahead and read.
Says, Lynn, at these meetings, you always add to my education. Please enhance my education by responding to the following question. Your expression of will seems to rule out action. Is it not true that the independence of thought is hampered without the will to act?
Well, I certainly am disposed to action, as I think you know, Senator. I get myself in a lot of trouble because I just don't think I act. I recommend that to people who have the courage to take that position. It's most gratifying, though sometimes physically painful. that's the issue. The problem, people become weak. You ask what makes cowards of people. I mean, anyone who's been in military service, for example, and I was in a very minor position in the training cadre for a period of time in my military service, you ask the question, is you look at the people you've got, you're supposedly training, and people you're associated with, and you say, what's going to happen when this well-known substance hits the fan? Which guy is going to go in which direction? And when you're even in a training situation, you're thinking in those directions. I mean, you've got some troops you're supposed to train. They've brought in their baskets, particularly from various parts of the country. You line them up on the company street, and you say, we just lost World War II, you know. So you think in terms, are you training people to become part of an effective functioning unit where one person in the unit can trust another and have confidence in one another? And how do you structure this thing to make it work that way? It comes to you as automatic. That's what you think about. Simple kinds of duties, simple kinds of things, the most routine type. When you have an organized situation, an organized function, that's what comes up. How are the various people in the association going to function? So the ability to fight, the ability to function in action depends upon something more than just having an opinion. Having an opinion isn't worth much. Having knowledge of what you should do and having a reasoned knowledge of what you should do is worth a great deal. Because if you think of immortality, as I emphasize it here today, if you think that you, the difference between you and an ape, that you are inherently immortal, because you are in the process, even in the time of your mortal life, span of life, you're in the process, hopefully, of contributing something and perpetuating, at least, and adding to the store of knowledge which will determine the improvement of the condition of humanity in times to come. And therefore, what's important to you is ideas which correspond to that mission. And you'll stake your life on that because you couldn't live with yourself if you didn't do it. This is having a conscience. Without that, you really don't have a conscience. If you're ashamed of doing this or ashamed of that, that's not a conscience. A conscience is a commitment to a sense of principle of what you're willing to spend your life for, either over a longer term or the very short term sometimes. So that's the issue. And thus, the function of education is to give the individual a sense of what it is they should be willing to die for, either by the expenditure of the span of their mortal life, if it comes in a peaceful way, or if you're confronted with something where you must choose to act or not to act, are you going to defend your immortal soul? And that gives you the maximum capacity to act. And also the maximum capacity to act with constraint, not to do something which goes against your morals. To do good, but not to abuse the power to act by doing something wrong to anybody or just by negligence.
I'll take another question from the audience, and then I'm going to go back and entertain a couple of institutional questions. I'd like to call Joe Joseph, who is president of UAW Local 1970 in Detroit, Michigan, up to the microphone. Mr. Joseph, are you here? There you are.
Hi, thank you. My question, Lynn, is it's about the Federal Reserve. Plain and simple, who is really running it? How is it run? Who does it take off the hook when it goes into receivership? Okay.
Well, first of all, I look at it this way because there are many things about it. First of all, I was stuck in as an attempt to introduce a European parliamentary form of government into the United States. And it was done by the combined efforts of two presidents in particular. There are others who are involved, but two presidents, Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. And it was done under Wilson initially, but it was done with the impetus supplied by Teddy Roosevelt, both of whom were two pro-Confederacy pigs, racist pigs, and not exactly good citizens of the United States. In a sense, it is tolerable in some degree. But it's not tolerable the way it's being run now. What it represents, essentially, is a group of leading banking institutions, directly, and other institutions are tied to them. Even the stock market, for example, is very closely tied to them right now. So these institutions form a body. It's a private body, largely, with some government restraint, some government individuals involved. But it tries to function as a control over the U.S. government. It tries to function like a European independent central bank, like the European Central Bank, which has no government. There is no government. There's no nation. It's a group of nations which are run by a private bank. The European Central Bank, the ECB. It's a swindle. It's part of a process of globalization. And the Fed tries to act that way. This is why I endorsed, and I wasn't exactly enthusiastic about his appointment as the new Treasury Secretary, but the idea of reinforcing the position of the Treasurer of the United States as an authority above the Federal Reserve Chairman was a step in the right direction institutionally, because the money, under our Constitution, the existence of debt of the United States, and it is the debt of the United States which is one of the key factors here in this system, in the Federal Reserve System. This is a responsibility, a constitutional authority of the federal government with the consent of the House of Representatives, essentially. So therefore, what has to be done with the Fed, it's bankrupt now, because all of the major banks inside the Federal Reserve System are directly or indirectly bankrupt and hopelessly bankrupt. Now, therefore, as acts prove, I'm President of the United States, I've got to save the U.S. economy. I've got to defend the U.S. dollar. For example, if some idiot comes up with the idea of devaluing the dollar say, dropping it to 80% of its present value. You know what that will do to the world system? It will immediately blow out the world financial banking system. Immediately. One of the most stupid ideas anyone could think of. So therefore, as President of the United States, I would have to be able to say, we in the United States are going to defend the current value of the dollar at parity. At current parity. That's the policy of the United States. That statement, made by a president who knows what he's doing and who can convince others that he does really know what he's doing, will be sufficient to stabilize the world system or provide the levers on which to do it. Now, what does that mean? Inside this Federal Reserve system, in dollar denomination, I've got the biggest mass of bankrupt paper you ever conceived of. The worst of it is financial derivatives and different kinds, like credit derivatives, the whole spot. Largely created by Alan Greenspan. So therefore, I simply say, well, financial derivatives are not covered by us. They're not debts of a normal kind. We didn't incur these debts. People issued financial derivatives gambling on our money. We're not responsible for you gamblers. We had no control over you. You didn't allow us to have any control over you. Therefore, we're not responsible for you. Forget your credit derivatives related obligations. They're gone, buddy. That takes the... Now you can start to breathe. We are also going to immediately issue, use the power of the federal government with the consent of a willing Congress, and the citizens of this country will really please help make the Congress willing. We're going to issue a series of long-term credit creation authorized by the House of Representatives for large-scale infrastructure projects like the recovery program we proposed on the auto industry. We're going to put up the credit to take these facilities, productive facilities, and do similar kinds of things in infrastructure, and we're going to expand productive employment in the United States to the degree that the actual income, the genuine income of the United States, is going to be increased. It's not only going to be increased in total amount, it's going to be increased in per capita. Because when we take people and shift them from employment, non-employment, or employment in services industry, unskilled services, and put them back into manufacturing or agriculture, good agriculture, now what we're doing, we are increasing the total income per capita at a high rate, national income. Therefore, now we also now have a larger tax revenue in just in the normal process of the tax rate. Communities which are shutting down now begin to be able to finance some of their own activities like schools and hospitals and normal things of that sort. So our job is to have a project to increase the total production of the United States using infrastructure as a starting point. Because if you build infrastructure, you issue contracts to private contractors to do this and that and so forth. You have subsidiary private industries that come in on this thing. So suddenly you have a multiplier factor. You increase the total product, and now you also increase the tax revenue income base to sustain local community, state activities, as well as federal. So now your rate of income as against your rate of current operating costs, is brought back into balance. All you have to do is increase the level of production in the United States per capita in the right form of capital intensity and technology, and suddenly you are above break-even, where presently we're operating at a substantial ongoing loss. So therefore, if I do that, then I can defy the world and say, look, we not only will honor this dollar and defend this dollar, we're going to make the dollar the strongest in the world. So you better hold on to it. And we're going to bring you in on the goodies by coming into long-term agreements among nations, which will give you a share of the benefit of this kind of recovery, which you can't do under your constitution, but we can do it under ours. You work with us, you get part of the pie. So that's the way you have to operate. You need that kind of vision. It's not a fantasy. This is the way the economy really works, when our system of economy, when the American system of political economy works the way it was intended. This is what we can do under modern circumstances. And that's what we need. And Joe, you know what we can do. We can just take these plants they were stealing and closing down, and just what we could generate out of that sector of the extended automobile sector is enough to give an impetus for going over from a loss economy to a growing economy. And all we need is the federal credit and the rules and the laws to make it work.
Lynn, the next question is from a Democratic member of the House of Representatives who is also a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. He says, Mr. LaRouche, I have all these questions mixed up here. Okay. All right. This is Mr. LaRouche. The Democratic Leadership Council's policy of triangulation, or of two Republican parties, seriously damaged Bill Clinton's presidency. The continued failures of Democrats to clearly differentiate themselves from the Republicans on questions of foreign policy and to stand up and fight as well for an economic Bill of Rights led to several other defeats, most notably John Kerry's defeat as a presidential candidate. But when George Bush made the mistake of trying to privatize Social Security, leaders of the Democratic Party locked ranks, stood before the FDR statue, and made clear that they would not allow this. The message that they delivered went beyond simply the issue of Social Security. It seemed that what they were actually saying is that the Democratic Party was reasserting itself as the party of FDR. At that time, I don't know how many people actually believed that the Democrats would prevail, given the fact that the Republicans had a majority in both houses. But in fact, they did prevail. My view at the time was that if nothing else had been accomplished, the DLC and this idea of two Republican parties had once and for all been discredited and put to rest. However, in the last few months, the DLC has come back and has come back strong. And they are exerting enormous influence in shaping the approach of the upcoming national elections. I assume that what he's referring to are the upcoming congressional elections. What do you think accounts for their ability to come back when they were so significantly discredited? And why has no one spoken out against it?
Well, there's some dirty work on the inside. It would happen to Clinton, as you referred to in the question. We saw that. I saw that personally. I saw it coming. I can give you a list of some of the names I know on the inside of the Democratic Party, inside the U.S. presidency at the time, who were responsible for this. Just think about the people who were publicly urged Clinton to resign so that Al Gore could become president. Who these guys were, and look at them today. Now, let's take another side of this thing. There are people in the DLC who have been controlling interests in it from the beginning, whose personal roots are in organized crime, or were in organized crime. And those who were not what is called organized crime, but what should have been called organized crime, like George Soros and Felix Rohatyn. So you have a type of mentality which historically we associate with an organized crime mentality. And these guys operate in the Democratic Party the way an organized crime boss in New York City in the old days operates in his ward. And they make threats, just as Rohatyn makes threats, just as Soros makes threats, just as Al Gore made the biggest ass in the world of himself in Southwest Asia against Malaysia, against the Prime Minister of Malaysia on a visit there. He should have been fired, should have been impeached for that performance. He was a disgrace to the human race. He should have been impeached from the human race for doing that. Let alone the Democratic Party, let alone the vice presidency. So that's where the problem lies. And when you're dealing in a neighborhood and your family is faced with threats from organized crime, and that's the way these guys operate. Steinhardt, Rohatyn and company, Soros and company, how do you think they operate? With bait and switch. If you're nice to you, I'll smile. Nice to me, I'll smile at you. If you don't, I'll kill you. And there are various ways to kill you. I'll kill your career. I've got something on you. I can cause a federal prosecution against you. I can cause an impeachment. I got something on members of your family. I control the people in your church. This and that and so forth. That's how it works. So you have to have the guts of a soldier to stand up against these kinds of guys. And when they're coming to get you, you meet with the other people who they're coming to get. And you develop a battle plan. Well, see, we did that. We remember what happened after the defeat in the election in 2000, then again the defeat in 2004. In both cases, I responded. In the end of November of 2000, I responded, and late we got something going. It was later destroyed. We went at projects, particularly, I warned what was going to happen exactly, and it did happen, didn't it? I said before Bush was inaugurated, because Bush is stupid and the economy had already begun to collapse, that the Bush administration would collapse, and therefore you have to look for something like what happened in Germany when Hermann Göring set fire to the Reichstag in order to create the crisis under which Hitler was given dictatorial powers. And Hitler didn't give up those dictatorial powers until the day he killed himself. And I said we had to expect that. Then we had 9/11. How'd that happen? You think it was a bunch of Arabs did that? Well, or do you think that something like the Kennedy assassination had happened? Similar kinds of things. Or what was done in Bombay, of Mumbai, just this couple of weeks ago, a major terrorist incident, comparable, not in maybe in scale, but comparable in type and backing to what happened on 9/11 in New York City, was done as a strategic move. A global strategic terrorist action was run in Mumbai, and it was run against Russia and the Shanghai Cooperation Council, as well as India. And it was run as an integral part of what the Israelis were being induced to do under Cheney's backing and other backing in case of what was going on now in Southwest Asia. Strategic move. We are now on the verge of going into something like World War II, but of a different form and worse, because the system is more vulnerable today than it was then. Asymmetric warfare spreading globally. You want it? You can have it. If we don't stop this thing in Southwest Asia and don't stop what Bush and Clinton are doing now, it's not the Israelis. The Israelis are being pushed. They're being demanded they do it. And they know it's stupid, but the United States is behind them and pushing them from behind. And that's the only reason they're doing it. And that, of course, is the reason why the cowardly Senate voted up endorsement for what Israel is being pushed into doing. Okay. So the point is, in this kind of situation, you have to understand the situation, you have to understand what you fight for, what you should fight for, and fight for it. You're up against something like the DLC, and you say, look, as I will say here and now, I've said before, I don't like those guys. They're no damn good. What do we need them for?
Lynn, the next question has come in a variety of forms by about a dozen people who have submitted questions via the Internet. So I'm just going to kind of summarize the question and let you deal with it. The question has to do with the fact that in your recent paper, you say that the Anglo-Dutch bankers have the intention of decreasing the world's population to less than 1 billion people. The question is why would they do that? And how does this benefit them? How does it benefit them to reduce the world's population to this level? And also, how exactly do they intend to do that?
You have in Northern Europe, in the area which is of Dutch in its provenance, you have Fleming, the Flemish, and the Dutch, which are essentially the same population next door to each other, one inside Belgium, one inside the Netherlands. Now, let's look at the profile of the life expectancy on both sides of the border among what is essentially the same cultural population. If you're 70 years of age and get the sniffles inside Dutch territory, you're dead. You look at the profile of the by age group of the Dutch population. Above 70, you're likely dead. You look at the Flemish population next door, same essential population, same culture. Plenty of people over 100 and over in their 90s. On the Dutch side, if you have an accident or an illness in the Dutch medical system, you have two levels. You have the actual emergency care, initial care, like the surgery and so forth. Then you're given into care. If you're given into care and you're over 70, goodbye. Now, that gives you some idea. If the Dutch will do that to themselves, their own people, what are you talking about, the Anglo-Dutch crowd? Now, the Dutch, there has this significance. Of course, people are people. Remember, these are Dutch. They have the same culture on both sides of the border, essentially. Essentially, the same morality on both sides of the border. So the same population of the same culture on one side of the border has a medical care for people up through several in their hundreds and significant number of their 90s. On the other side of the border, empty. Empty. So therefore, it's from the top, isn't it? It's not from the people, but it's from their government. That's where the difference is. Now, what's the Dutch government? Well, the guy who created Felix Verhaeten out of mud or some less noble material was Meyer and Company with Worms family. Were the connection of the Syndicus International based in Paris into Royal Dutch Shell of Dieterding. Dieterding was one of the major funders of Adolf Hitler. Dutch. Power in the Dutch royal family. Dieterding and company were also tied to the British royal family through institutions such as the Bank of Scotland, which is the British royal family's private bank, and similar institutions of the London system. So what you have is you have a triangle, which historically goes back to the days of Napoleon Bonaparte, the time that Napoleon was defeated. which the Banque de France, which was created by Napoleon, together with the Dutch and the British banking system, the Anglo-Dutch liberal banking system, formed a triangle of power of imperial implications. This is what we fought against in defending our United States. This is what we fought against in the American Revolution. Now, this crowd wants an empire. Now, it's very difficult to maintain an empire with intelligent people as victims. You want people to be stupid. Now, the first thing you want to do is you want to kill off people who are too smart because they're troublesome. They're troublemakers. Kill them. Imprison them. That's what they did with me. Get them out of the way. Too dangerous. Now, and you also take some other steps. Make them stupid. How do you make them stupid? Well, don't give them intelligent employment. Eliminate technological progress. Limit technological progress to know-how to repeat and carry out certain recipes, like formulas, like recipes. But don't have scientific thinking. Eliminate classical culture. Because classical culture breeds a high quality of intellect where popular music destroys it, for example. Don't educate them much. Give them menial labor to do. Now, what does that mean? That means if you reduce the intellectual level, the skill level of the population in general, you lower the productive potential of the population and of the society. We now have over 6 billion people on this planet. If you go to a post-industrial orientation, you can't maintain a population of 6 billion people. If you do what they're doing now, the trend that's going now, you're going to reduce the world's population potential to between 500 million and 750 million people, is a fair estimate. And you'll do that in a fair share of time. Therefore, if you know these are your policies, you know you're going to have to reduce the population. If you want your population to be significant as a factor in the empire you're creating, together with your accomplices, then you want to manage your population the way you manage a herd of cattle. 70 buddy, you're out. Lame, sick, incurable illness, you're out. Serious accident, you're out. You purify the population. Population purification. In anticipation of a general collapse. That's the mentality you're dealing with. People don't know that this is what you're dealing with. This is the enemy. This is read the stuff. Know even our American financial oligarchy. They have the same ideas. Who introduced euthanasia to European civilization? It wasn't Germany. The German euthanasia program came from the United States, from the Harrimans and Company. And was practiced in South Carolina and Virginia and so forth earlier here. This is the mentality of what we're up against. We're up against the most evil people of importance on this planet today. And we have many of them right here, as well as in the Netherlands. And if you want to see it, all you have to do is look at the facts. Look at health care. Look at the HMO system. What do you think it is? It's a population reduction system. And the rate of population reduction through HMO is about to increase savagely. Don't we know that? It's already ongoing. What about pensions? Useless bums getting high salaries at General Motors and they're not qualified to wind a watch, let alone run a corporation. Look at the golden parachutes they get after a few years of disservice to the corporation. What is a guy who's worked for the airline or something else or General Motors, what happened to his pension? The guy who produced, who thought he had a pension, he thought he had a health care plan, what happened to it? It was taken away. Why did it have to be? Well, they have this important guy. He needs a golden parachute. And you guys, we don't need you anymore.
So you know what you can do? You can go off and die. You don't have health care? Well, you may die. So what? You're not. It's not important, is it? You don't have a job anymore, do you? No reason to live, do you? No. People have to learn the lesson and stop covering their eyes when they're looking at pure evil. Some of it's abroad. We have a lot of it right here. Some of it even in the leadership of the Democratic Party.
I'd like to call on someone from here in the audience. Tony Carrington, who's the vice president of UAW Local 696 in Dayton, Ohio. Do you want to ask your question or you want me to read it? And where are you? You want me to read it? Okay. It says, Lynn, you've spoken many times on the subject of retooling the American automotive workforce. My question is this. Could you please explain how the government precisely should intervene to make this a real possibility, and then the reciprocating effects of this massive undertaking?
Well, what I probably would do is I'd probably have the government set up, in this case, a corporation, to take in these idle capacities as integral parts. We know we can have one big cost saving. We can eliminate most of the managements because they don't do anything. Look at what I'm not going into detail. I can give you technical details of what some things are. But these guys are nothing but parasites. They're overlords. And they're in there for a short term. They're not building anything. Look at the deterioration in the relative quality of GM, Ford, and other products relative to their competitors. The technological improvement is not there. They're not mission-oriented. They haven't been mission-oriented since about 1990. They gave up the mission orientation when they went to computer design as opposed to machine tool design, real machine tool design, original machine tool design. Now, we have a lot of things which are high-gain tasks. We have labor force in cities, towns, where the town as a whole depends upon these industries. So the point is to keep these things in place where they are, because every one of them, and look at this by going through the list of what the potentials are, every one of them has a potential as a part of building things the United States actually needs. So we're not only merely trying to restore and maintain the U.S. economy, where we have a productive labor force as opposed to people who have no training whatsoever, but we're also going to create new products which are better and more useful for the United States than the kind of automobiles they were producing. For example, fixing the locks and dams and so forth of the river systems is high gain. Shifting over into high rates of developing high-temperature gas-cooled nuclear reactors in which these kinds of capabilities can be mastered. Building a national rail system again in modern technology. These plants have the ability within a year or so to start making things which are relevant to these kinds of projects for which some of the designs already exist. So therefore, if the government takes over, we keep the jobs, but we produce new things. We don't need as many automobiles. We've had too many. If we had a mass transit system, if you look at a traffic jam around any part of the United States, you see what the lack of mass transit does. You see the way the cities are organized. They're getting too big. And the traffic jams, the inefficiencies of the cities are there too big. They should be smaller and more diversified. Less emphasis on a single product. So therefore, we build up that sort of thing. And in that way, we actually increase the productivity per capita of the whole U.S. population. Producing automobiles at ridiculous prices relative to the way they've been doing, with these give away this and give away that, not overproducing automobiles, but shifting automobile capacity, and especially its machine tool capacity, into these categories, is automatically, immediately, an increase in the productive powers of labor in the United States and improvement of the economy. And by shifting this to kinds of products which will be beneficial to the entire economy, we increase the productivity of the labor force. Now, you don't need the management because all you have to do is have some responsible people who represent the corporation which is created to take over these entities. And you can find among the people who are working in the plant as the actual plant managers, plant manager types, product manager, design manager. You put them in charge of the plant because that's what they're going to do. They're going to come up with these ideas. Wherever you have good machine tool operatives, of senior machine tool design operatives, in the automobile industry, you have people who are innately innovative. If you have a system of communication and government participation to fight out what the projects will be and where they'll occur, you will find the design engineers can do the job. Maybe it could be done better, but it would be good enough. Which means you start to move the population into a new categories, a new expansion of technology. Then we can do something else. We have a lot of youth who are being destroyed. We've got to move these youth out of the places they live because what's happened is the place they live has become a disease in itself. They're being raised in a disease. If you move them out as we did with the CCCs, you move them out of there as AmeriCorps represents a potential for doing that, and move them for a period of a year or two into development in special projects where they're going to be educated, where they're going to get some of the rot out of their system from the old hood, get the rot out of the system. And they will amount to something on their own. So now you take a section of the population which is a cost factor and a waste and a human obscenity, and you move these young people into an area where they can become part of the future of the nation and have a future of their own, and make the nation richer by being employed in things which are useful to the nation as a whole. And you don't need these guys with their golden parachutes. I would suggest a cast iron or a concrete parachute would be better.
We have another question, Lynn, from the House of Representatives, from a Democratic member of the House. Mr. LaRouche, although there was some early opposition to some of FDR's programs to get the United States out of the Depression, ultimately FDR prevailed because of two things. One, certainly he did organize the support of the vast majority of the American people. But second, he actually was able to employ cooperation from industrialists and to a certain degree from some bankers. Can we actually launch a reconstruction effort in the United States without the cooperation of the American banks? And I ask you this very specifically because of your criticism of Felix Rohatyn.
Well, the first way to improve the United States economy is get rid of Felix Rohatyn. Ship him back to Paris where he can be the parasite he loves to be. These guys are no damned good. NDG, no damned good. You don't need them. There are enough people in the banking area as professionals, as bankers, who know enough about what they do that they can do the job that needs to be done. Now, first of all, the banks are going to be closed down. They are dead. They are dead things sucking on the blood of the living. Now, I'm on the side of the living. not the dead things. The no NDG, no good dead things. Right? We don't need them. No one can convince me we need any of them. It's a disease. I do not need diseases. My body does not require diseases. I'm old enough. I don't require any new diseases. Or even some of the old ones. So therefore, what we need is a federal banking system which is based on salvaging some of the most talented bankers we have in the system who are personally talented and giving them a mission to work with the government to take banks which are otherwise going to be go bank out totally and take these banks with all the assets, the deposits, all the things associated with them, and keep them functioning under government protection until they can stand on their own feet. And the federal money will be funneled in large ways, the federal credit will be funneled to these banking institutions to where it has to go. We have to maintain a supply of credit to communities, both private and public. We have to maintain the level of functioning of essential institutions. We have to keep the level of employment in the country up above break-even. This we will do through cooperation of the federal government and the banking system largely, because the banking system will be responsible also to make sure that states and localities also have a program of credit coming in through there to keep these communities functioning. We cannot have a disintegration of the United States in part or whole. So we need bankers for that. Felix Rohatyn is simply a predator. You want to see what his predators do. Now, the difference between Felix and his predecessors, the people behind the Nazis in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, these guys commanded technological competence. The people associated with Felix Rohatyn do not have technological competence. They belong to the post-industrial society. They are the epitome of it. You want to keep them out of it, no matter how much money they might have had, and I don't think that Felix has much honest income to lend to anyone. If you take away the dishonest income, I don't think there's much to lend. So therefore, you don't want them because they're useless at their best. And if you turn them loose, they're criminal. You see what they're doing. You see what they do in various parts of the world. There is no rational reason, an honest reason, for any Democrat to defend Felix Rohatyn. There's no intelligent and honest Democrat who could make a rational case for justifying keeping Felix Rohatyn in the system.
Next question is from a Washington, D.C. Journalist and syndicated columnist. He says, Mr. LaRouche, you made no public comment regarding the Fitzgerald decision not to indict Karl Rove. However, recently published statements by Mr. Novak leave little doubt that Karl Rove did exactly what we suspected he did in leaking Valerie Plame's name to the press. Why do you think the decision was made not to indict him? And how harmful do you think this is in terms of the overall drive to undermine Cheney's influence in this administration?
Well, the basic responsibility for what should have been done on Rove is that the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party became almost a fellow traveler of the Bush administration. And that happened with the Alito nomination issue fight in February of this past year. And the rate of degeneration of the Democratic Party in terms of behavior, in terms of morals and practice, and timidity, and plain sheer gutlessness, has created a wide open situation where there was no significant pressure on Rove anymore. And because some of the right wing in the Democratic Party, typified by the down, lousy, and cheating DLC, where this thing became such a factor that wanted to reach an accommodation with the Bush White House. You had an offer from that side, from Texas, from a well-known law firm down there, which is associated with George H.W. Bush. And they thought they could have a manageable deal with the White House. And the Democrats thought they could buy into it. However, I think that the damage should not be exaggerated. Fitzgerald has crafted a case which, from my understanding, he intended to prosecute after the November election, on an idea that his office would not be involved in a situation where the midterm election would be a factor going into the election, where the this case would be a factor going into the election, but to deal with it afterward. I think, in a sense, that still stands. I think to what Joe Wilson is doing, Ambassador Joe Wilson and his wife are doing, it makes sense. It's probably what they should do. But we cannot, at the same time, while saying let's not exaggerate the significance of Fitzgerald's apparently letting Rove off the hook, let's not exaggerate that after taking note of probably the Democratic Party's weakness and moral weakness was a factor in there. The thing isn't done yet. And besides, in the meantime, if we don't get rid of Rohatyn from the Democratic Party and from the government, we're not going to have an election. It doesn't mean a damn thing. And the Fitzgerald trial of Libby doesn't mean a damn thing. If the Democratic Party continues to play footsie with Rohatyn and people like him, it doesn't mean a thing. We're going to lose the country anyway.
Okay, just a couple of more questions. One is from an international guest, and the other is from the LaRouche Youth Movement. This question is from Mr. Larry Fujukwo from the Center for Political Leadership and Communications Research in Lagos. He says, Mr. LaRouche, what will be the fate of the oil-producing nations and of OPEC over the next 10 years, especially with increasing inflation and political instability in the emerging democracies in Africa?
The day in which petroleum continues to be the primary source of power among nations is coming to a close. Now, this doesn't mean that the use of petroleum as such has come to a close. It means that this, apart from the fact that the present rise in the price of petroleum product is a result of speculation by people like the friends of Rohatyn. If you don't like high gas prices, gas Rohatyn instead. The reality is there is no hope for this planet in the medium term without a full gain shift to nuclear power as the primary and rapidly expanding principal source of power on this planet for various kinds of uses, including industrial applications. One benchmark of that is that people are brainwashed into believing that by counting calories, you can compare different sources of power. To understand and define power, you have to go to your chemistry manuals. And you have to take the level at which certain kinds of reactions, such as simple chemical reactions, nuclear reactions, or atomic reactions and nuclear reactions occur. Now, we're in a period where we need a high gain at fairly low costs of desalination and processing of water in order to meet the primary requirements of consumable water by populations. Probably 20% of the world's consumption of fresh water depends upon fossil water sources. As you see in the United States in the Oglala case, We're losing in the United States large, the principal amounts of fossil or semi-fossil stocks of water. We're turning the West into a dust bowl by the way we use water. Now, the way you, there's plenty of water on the planet. The question is you have to process it. And you have to process it at an acceptable price for mass use. That means along our coasts in particular, we should have many nuclear power plants, particularly of the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor type. These plants, if you go in the 800-megawatt class, will also be useful for turning water, such as salt water, into fuel. The Great Lakes, other areas, can produce carbon-based fuel, methane, essentially, or methane-like fuels, or methane-related fuels, and reduce these, which are more efficient than natural gas otherwise, because natural gas contains many other things, and more efficient than petroleum. We should be powering our planes by petroleum. We should, and so forth and so on. I mean by methane, or by synthetic methane. So therefore, in order to meet simply the requirement on a global scale, of even simple things like fresh water supplies for human consumption and producing fuels to replace the diminishing, at economical prices, diminishing sources of fuels, we require high-temperature gas-cooled reactors. Now, we at the same time are going into a shift over the next quarter century into a thermonuclear fusion economy. Already, we are using one of our biggest parts of our economy, which is shown in the medical health application area, is an isotope management. That is, isotope variables of elements play a crucial part in dealing with things like cancer, drugs, and things like that. But we're using a lot of these, and we're using a great amount of it. What is going to happen as we go further with a growing world population demanding raw materials, finished raw materials, to sustain human life, we're going to shift into an isotope economy from a simple atomic economy. That is, we're going to be using isotopes in new ways to make new kinds of products which are needed to meet a growing demand. Because the biosphere in which all of the things that we normally consume, from which we think are extracted, is finite. It's large, it's finite. It's a major and growing part of the planet. But we are using up the richest loads of certain kinds of atomic elements and so forth. We're using these up more rapidly than they can be replenished by natural means. Therefore, we must go to the point of changing our conception of chemistry in going to what might be called an isotope economy in terms of energy, and we can do that best economically with thermonuclear fusion. Therefore, we must proceed fairly rapidly toward thermonuclear fusion. Now, this means, contrary to President Bush's stupid ideas about Iran, that every nation has the right and obligation to become qualified in these technologies because they have to apply them. They have to be qualified to administer them and to use them. And that should be our purpose. Now, what we will do, therefore, is we will develop petroleum resources, but instead of shipping petroleum around the world as a raw fuel, we are going to, if we're intelligent, we're going to use it as a production feedstock for chemical production, producing plastics and other things in places where they can are extracted. These will then be shipped, if they're shipped, as a higher value per ton product to various parts of the world, thus reducing the cost factor in moving the stuff around the world, and also in relieving the pressure on the high rates of consumption of petroleum as a simple fuel. So that's our project. So in the case of Nigeria, there should be an orientation toward both a combination of nuclear power development and the development of petroleum with the view of getting a high technology petroleum industry based where the petroleum is to produce products which are based on petroleum as a raw material stock. And that will be our future. For the next 10 years or so, that is what we should be doing.
Okay, Lynn, the final question comes from several members of the Washington, D.C. LaRouche Youth Movement. And, I mean, you have to admit that these guys have their work cut out for them. I have to say, when a member of Congress submits a question saying, why is it that no members of Congress are standing up and speaking out against the Democratic Leadership Council, you have to laugh. I mean, you have to take it with a certain amount of humor. I mean, sometimes I think that I should just walk around Capitol Hill with a mirror and hold it up every now and then. But anyway, the question is, okay, Lynn, from what you've said, as far as our work in Washington, D.C. is concerned, just to be clear, our message to the Congress seems to be, in no particular order, impeach Cheney, dump Rohatyn, and support LaRouche's economic reconstruction plan. Is that about right?
Well, let's not get off cheap. Look, these are all tasks, but that's not enough. Because, see, you have to think about somebody's going to carry a job, get a job done. What's going to nourish their strength in doing it? All right. Bach. Bach. To develop your soul. Because without a soul, you'll find that you may collapse easily. And also it makes you a more social human being, which is what you have to be, particularly when you think of the background you come from. You think about your parents' generation. Ugh. You got a problem, buddy. You got to deal with that. Secondly, you have to have a scientific orientation of the type I indicated. Now, what we've done, we referred again to it today, this question about what is creativity? Now, we're going to be running a program out of Leesburg in which we'll be doing more in the direction that you need of showing you how to handle this concept of animations. It's not wipes. The point is very simple. I give you two functions. Let me give you, say, a function. Say, I use the case of Kepler's principle of gravitation, and take a subject like the Mars orbit, which is done by a number of our people who have done this repeatedly. So you know that quite well. Now, how do you isolate? How did Kepler isolate from that question? How did he isolate the idea of a universal principle of gravitation, which he and he alone discovered originally? No one ever discovered it before him or actually made a claim to an original discovery of it after that it was competent. What's the difference? An elliptical orbit doesn't explain anything, as you know. You've been through that, I presume. Right? Because you have a rate of change of the vector at every infinitesimal point in the orbit. Now, you can take an estimate of another different orbit. You can compare the two. How can you compare an orbit conceived as functioning without gravitation as a principle, simply as some kind of pathway, and the orbit is actually generated by the motion along the orbital pathway? Because what happens is the two measurements you would make would be two different curves, and you would find the answer lies between the two. Where does the answer come up? It comes up as an infinitesimal. Now, how's an infinitesimal reflected? When you have two so-called linear or simple algebraic formulas, and somewhere between the two of them, the answer lies. And the answer lies with an infinitesimal. The infinitesimal is what? The infinitesimal, in this case, is gravity. Gravity is as big as the universe. It defines the finiteness of the universe, right? But how can you locate gravity at a point? No, you can't. You can locate the action of gravitation at a point, at an infinitesimal. So gravitation doesn't exist as an ontological thing at any point. It exists as something which is universal, which has an effect on every point. And at every point it appears as an infinitesimal. Now, how can you represent an infinitesimal in mathematics? You can't, except by a complex function. What does a complex function mean? It means that. Now, what do you do? Let's take towns and cities in the United States. We're trying to find out what is the effect of a certain principle, which means a mode of action, like a technology, in that town or that county. Well, you study the case of having the two curves. One, the curve of development, by using the simple kind of we do with our county studies on animations. You compare the animation for one state and another state. The other state is after the introduction of a principle to that county. So now you're looking for the effect of the introduction of an application of a principle to that county, or the result of removing that principle as a principle of action in that county. It will be reflected as a discontinuity on a second-order curve or a third-order curve. So that's how in analyzing county by county, you can determine what is the effect which is caused by taking something out of a county or adding something into it. What's the effect of going from an industrial economy, a high-gain agricultural economy, to a post-industrial economy in that county? What is the principle? You will look at the data, and the data will show as a discontinuity, either added or being subtracted, at the point that change is made. So it doesn't show itself as a thing, as a point. It shows itself as a sudden change in the direction of curvature. It shows itself as a discontinuity. So therefore, it's extremely important that in your understanding and arguing with people and trying to explain to people what is happening to the U.S. economy, how we were degenerated, how we were deindustrialized, and what the effect of the deindustrialization was, what the effect of going to lower technology, what the effect of greening the economy was. And looking, therefore, on those principles, what will be the predictable effect of putting the principles into application that should be there? For example, what would be the effect of increasing the amount of water in certain counties in the United States, like the Oglala, particularly in the southern part of the Oglala area? What would be the effect? You want to know, for the purposes of economic policy, what the effect would be and judge your priorities accordingly. So how do you know that? Well, you have to be familiar with making these kinds of studies instead of just doing the simple kind of thing that's generally done in the government operations, to locate, pinpointing singularities. The singularities which, by adding or subtracting, affect certain changes in the economy. So therefore, you need to do your daily work, but when you're walking with someone with Congress or an official somewhere here or there, so forth, trying to explain something to them, it's important that you sharpen yourself. First of all, improve your soul by learning to sing better. And Bach, for example. And improving your ability to cope with the specific kind of questions which any politically relevant person would raise with you. What do you think is the effect of this, and what do you think would be the effect of this? Therefore, familiarity with animations which deal with this thing in this way is very important, because now you know how to think in order to answer or get the answer to those questions. So that is the thing that makes you feel strong. And when you feel strong because you're learning to sing better, and you feel strong because your mind is improving, then you go out as a stronger person rather than just going out and doing something.
Thank you.
Okay. I think that brings today's event to a close. I would ask people as they exit to visit the literature table outside and make sure that you're well supplied with ammunition for this fight. It will definitely improve your soul, and probably if you take enough literature, your body as well. Otherwise, please join me once again in thanking Lynn.